kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Another reviews episode lined up for you. We got a party cast later in the show, but we're starting things off with Tim Ekibis. Tim, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How's it going?
It's going pretty good on this end.
Yeah.
How was your weekend?
It was good. Yeah, it was fine. I cared for a child. He's still alive. He made it. And then, man, did it shit the bed right at the end, right around, like, 10:20 on Sunday night.
Oh, boy, what happened?
Well, I don't know if you watched the WWE Hell in a Cell pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Oh, man.
It is like, you know, I don't have a lot of time to sit and watch wrestling. Though ironically, like, NXT's move to a 2-hour format has forced me to, like, make time to watch it, because it used to be like, oh, it's just an hour. Well, I'll just, like, binge it, you know?
Yeah.
I'll just, you know, I can catch up. Now I'm like, no, I can't catch up. I have to watch the show every weekend. I will fall behind. But, you know, I don't always, sit and watch, like, the kind of the lesser pay-per-views live. But this, you know, I had Hell in a Cell, you know, I had it on the background, but, you know, I stopped what I was doing and gave it my full attention when they were doing, when it got to the main event of Seth Rollins versus The Fiend in Hell in a Cell. And man, it was just one of those nights that makes you question why you still watch this shit.
It really was.
It really was. It was just like, man, he's just lying there. The Fiend is just lying there, just getting hit. What was hit with all this stuff, like, and
just a whole bunch of curb stomps over and over and over. Yeah, and
like, that was kind of like the first curb stomp, like, sequence and cover and kick out at one. I was like, okay, I like this. This is good. But the Fiend never got up off the mat after that point. He just kept lying there and just like, okay, we hit him with the chair, then we hit him with the ladder. Then we put the chair inside the ladder and hit it with a toolbox a bunch of times. Then we hit all that metal with a sledgehammer, and then we have crossed the line.
Yeah. A DQ finish, or a ref stoppage finish.
Fucking whatever.
In Hell in a Cell.
It was a DQ finish until they changed their damn minds.
See, the thing is, if it was a ref stoppage, isn't that technically a win for Seth?
It is technically a win for Seth, which I think is what they're saying, is that it's a win for, but they, you know, they never announced the decision. It was just bad. The thing is, he called the match right after Seth used the sledgehammer. He didn't check on the Fiend and then call the match. He checked for damage and said, oh, he cannot continue. He threw Seth out for violence, and then they changed the story later and apparently didn't really mention it so much on Raw last night.
No, and they kind of glossed over it on Raw.
Yeah, I don't think you want the whole red lighting thing, I don't think that was a good idea, but you don't want your show ending with people chanting for AEW.
Or just a chorus of boos as it goes off the air.
Yeah, or unless you're an AEW show, you don't want your show ending with a chance of AEW. So that was a disaster. But NXT is still good, and Dynamite's on now, so that's also great.
Yeah, Wednesdays are pretty crazy now.
Yeah, actually, and they just put up the dark matches from last week, which is like four matches on their YouTube. So, or I think it's on TNT's YouTube, I don't remember, but yeah. Yeah, they just put up the dark matches for free, so I'm going to check those out tomorrow. Because they matter. They matter. The wins and losses on those episodes matter.
It's weird that AEW is going to have wins and losses that actually matter and keep track of them.
Oh, they're still. Oh, they play it live starting at 7. I just opened it and it's live. People are saying Jungle Boy isn't that good and they are jerks. I'll catch this later. Anyways, Whew. So, yeah. Yeah. What'd I do? Yeah. I finished Fire Emblem. That's what I did this weekend. I made it my business to finish that game. It's a good game right there.
The
I
new special one? Made it. Three houses.
Oh, that is so good. It is a very good Fire Emblem. But yeah, I had to get it finished because, you know, Zelda already came out, and then I picked up Dragon Quest, and I am reviewing another tactical role-playing game for a little later this month, and I was just like, nope, I gotta get Three Houses done and gone. I was right at the end, and I pushed through and finished it off on Sunday night, I believe. I think it was Saturday night. Yeah, it was late Saturday night. Yeah. 50 hours.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's a healthy amount of time.
It is. It took me 2 months to do it, but I got through it.
Yeah, I need to play that game, but I just picked up Link's Awakening today. I gave up waiting for Best Buy to ship me the Dreamer Edition. I give up. It's not going to come. I'm going to wait until the 23rd or whenever it is that I'm allowed to actually cancel my order, and then I'll cancel the order, and I'm not going to get it. So I just picked up the regular Link's Awakening today.
You'll let the dream die.
Yeah. I want to play the goddamn game. I'm tired of waiting.
Yeah. Yeah, my kid very much enjoys watching that game, which is heartwarming. I mean, obviously, it is a wonderful, charming-looking game, but, you know, the way he lights up whenever, you know, I find a cave or a seashell or, you know, we find a key in a dungeon, you know, it's like, oh, man, yeah, it's cool. Zelda is connecting with him, and that's good. And now he's talking about dressing up as Link for Halloween, and I'm like, perfect.
Hell yeah.
Perfect. I didn't even have to trick you into doing it. We'll see. I don't know. I have the feeling he might still end up as Captain America, but we'll see how it goes.
It'll be a win either way.
Yeah.
But we should probably get to the business at hand here.
Yes.
You got one game to talk about before we get to our party cast.
Yeah, before the party starts.
Yes, before the party starts, you're the pre-show.
Yeah, great.
You're the match on the pre-show.
When you put it like that, it sounds awful.
But this is actually a really important one. This game I'm excited to chat about this one. First game to talk about tonight is called Indivisible, developed by Lab Zero Games, published by 505 Games. It released October 8th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $39.99. Indivisible is an action RPG platformer featuring stunning hand-drawn art and animation, combined with unique real-time combat mechanics. Immerse yourself in a fantastical world with dozens of playable characters, a rich storytelling experience, gameplay that's easy to learn but difficult to master, and the trademark razor-sharp quality that Lab Zero Games is known for. Tim, tell us about Indivisible.
Indivisible. Man, this game has been a long time coming.
It has.
I was like kind of worrying about it at some point. So there was an Indiegogo. It was crowdfunded 4 years ago. I was going to say that, like, I remember I wanted to back this game, but I couldn't for some reason. Why couldn't I at the time? It's like, oh, right. I had an infant. So either I didn't have any money or I couldn't remember to. And my wife wasn't working. So it was not the time to be backing games on a Kickstarter. Yeah. So, I at some point they ended up releasing a like PS4 theme, which has been one of my themes for a long time on my PS4, which is funny. And it was funny to tell my wife, like, hey, you know that game that you always hear that music and see that girl running? The game's coming out now, finally. So yeah, here it is, Lab Zero Games, the follow-up to Skullgirls, that fighting game from so long ago at this point, which is also an awesome fighting game. And there is clearly some shared DNA between that game and this game that I'll get into here. So yeah, Indivisible. This is a 2D RPG. The most like direct line you can draw is to Valkyrie Profile, which is like a 20-year-old game at this point. As I wither away to dust in my seat.
My back hurts.
Yeah. So unlike a lot of RPGs, it doesn't take place from a top-down perspective. It takes place from a side-scrolling perspective. So you kind of run and jump and climb around an environment as you would in a 2D platformer, side-scroller, Metroidvania type deal, and you will see enemies on the map, and you can run up and hit them to enter combat. And then once you get into combat, you will have a party of four characters, and each character gets assigned one of the face buttons. So, well, platform depending, it's X, A, B, Y. So that covers two platforms, at least. So each character gets assigned a face button, and in combat, when you push that button, that character will do an attack. And as you play the game, you will get, I guess you'd say attack charges, or, you know, you get into combat and like your little circles will fill in. And once you get a full circle, you can use an attack, and it grows from like 1 to 2 to 3, et cetera, et cetera. How many attacks your characters can unleash at once. The game is kind of like the setting is like Tibet, like Himalayan, like that kind of,
mountainous.
Yeah. Like mountainous, like that section of like Asia, that is kind of like where it's drawing its, mythology and setting, which is cool because you don't see that very often. You, follow this girl who, you know, life is grand until the evil empire shows up and burns her town to the ground and kills her father. I'd say spoiler, but that's in like the first 5 minutes. And thus from there, she, starts absorbing people into her head and going on to this giant quest. Wait, what? So this girl has this ability to, she just absorbs people into like this astral realm in her head. And this is how you start building out like your party and cast of characters. But the adventure goes on as she's like, okay, well, I need to get revenge for my father and go kill this emperor. And then things escalate from there. And there are larger issues that need to be dealt with. So you're going on this grand quest, meeting different characters, trying to save the world. Really, the battle system is the star of this show. Like I said, it has this, again, this is also like Valkyrie Profile, in that you have your face buttons assigned to different characters. And this is it. Whew, man, it is something of a battle system. Like, it is the most brain intensive battle system I think I've played in an RPG since The World Ends With You. I almost called it The World Is Not Enough. That's a James Bond movie. The World Ends With You. Which was a DS game where you had to like keep an eye on things going on both screens using touch and button control. It was wild. But in this game, so actions can take place at any time. So you could be, you know, waiting for your little action points to fill, and enemies can still attack you. And when an enemy attacks you, your characters automatically, now when you push the button, then they go into defense. And if you hit block at the right time, you'll do a perfect block and take less damage. So along with like trying to get your moves ready, you have to keep an eye on what the enemy is doing and like what character the enemy is going to attack, because you need to hit the corresponding button for the character they're going to attack. Or if it's an attack that hits the whole party, you want to hit the left bumper, which yep. makes your whole party defend. But you don't want to do that all the time because it drains your meter. Okay. So you have these characters, and when you go on the offense, you're basically setting up combos. Each character has three different actions they can take, whether you just hit, like, say, X, up an X, or down an X. And you will have, you know, moves that hit low, moves that are launchers that will knock enemies up into the air, moves that just hit straight ahead. And the characters are just massively varied, which I'll get into in a second. So you will like unload these combos using your four characters to try to do the most damage. Like sometimes you'll need to break an enemy's defense. Sometimes you'll have to meet like there's some bosses with unique properties where you need to, you know, do certain things in order to actually do damage and knock down the boss's life bar. Characters have special attacks. So like the aforementioned meter, there is a meter that builds up at the top of the screen. And initially it's only one section, and eventually it will be three sections, which then lets you bust out like level 2 and level 3 special attacks. So, you know, you can set up these big combos and then finish them off with like a level 3 special attack. This sounds like a fighting game, does it not? go figure, this team just made a fighting game previous to making this game. but you gain meter by doing attacks and by hitting like those perfect defenses and that stuff. So that's all that is involved in the combat. And believe what I say, like, it is very involved. Like, there's some enemies that are slow, and it does ease you into it a little bit, but it definitely hit a point, like, a couple hours in where I was just like, man, this game, like, is rocking the shit out of me. Like, enemies were attacking so fast before I could really get my bearings, and it was a point when my characters, like, weren't that powerful, and the battles were definitely a bit of a slog at that point, and I was kind of, like, questioning if I was going to end up liking this game because of that. But that's just kind of I am pleased to say that was just kind of a little bit of a lull a few hours in, and then business picked up. basically, like, right when you, okay, so scattered around the world are these, like, red gems, and you collect these gems, you meet characters that when you can exchange the gems in order to upgrade your abilities. So, like, once you do that first upgrade, which takes 5 gems, you get that, like, that third action point in battle. You get, well, actually, I think it was, like, right around the same time that, like, my meter expanded, and things really started to pick up from there. Well, that and some characters that I found. So there are a ton of characters in this game. When they say there are dozens of characters in this game, they are not telling you a joke. There are lots of different characters that you will meet along the way that will take up residence inside your brain dome. and one of the things that, you know, I really liked about Skullgirls is they did a really good job of, one, building out, like, the whole universe for their fighting game. Like, when they were doing their, they had an Indiegogo to add characters to the game, and after that they had a vote to add, like, some other characters in the game, and they had this big list of, like, 20 different characters they could add, and each character had, like, backstory and, you know, descriptions of what their gameplay would be like, and it was just like, I was like, can I get all of these characters? Because they all just sounded so interesting. So, like, something Lab Zero definitely has down pat is one, world building, and two, like, how do you make interesting, unique characters to play around with? And that is, for me, like, what really makes this game fun. Like, it has, like, some shortcomings that I'll talk about, but just, like, having so many different characters to experiment with in different combinations, and nothing, you know, there are some characters that are, you know, just kind of a straightforward fighter or whatever, you know, that they pretty much have, you know, like, whatever, you go in there and you attack and then you step away. There are some that are a little bit less interesting, but you have, I have a couple different healer characters, and, like, one of them is this little girl called Ginseng and Honey. I think Honey is the plant that lives in her hat. but she has a giant, like, mortar and pestle, which she will run up and grind in the enemy's face. And the more you grind it up on the enemy, the more powerful her healing ability is. And so that's how she heals. It's like, okay, you just go up, you hit the enemy a bunch of times, and then you get stronger healing. There's another character you get who is like a water mage who just, like, produces water from her hair. And so when she attacks, or if you use her special, it'll just drop puddles, like, near your characters or near where she is standing. And then when you use her healing ability, it will heal your characters that are standing near the puddles, and it will hurt enemies that are standing near the puddles. So it's, like, two different ways of doing healing. One is very straightforward, and the other, like, involves positioning and thought and, like, what you're doing with the water, etc. But they have, you know, their pluses and minuses. One of my favorite characters is this little girl who has a giant fucking bird that is much larger than she is that hangs out on her arm, and you command the bird, you know, the bird can do a diving attack, or you can, like, fly up off the screen on the bird, like a Dragoon jump attack from Final Fantasy. There are, you know, there's a swamp witch with a with a dead tiger spirit inside of her that uses fire attacks. There's, like, an archer dude that, you know, shoots arrows. There's pirates. There's, like, all kinds of different characters, and they each have their own unique twist on like how their abilities work, how their specials work. You know, they might damage your characters. They might, you know, they might not be particularly strong, but they can do debuffs, or they could attack like a crowd of enemies. You know, some enemies are strong against these elements, so you'd have to swap those characters out. So what's just a lot of fun is just swapping in different characters, which you can do between battle at any time, and just trying out different combinations and just seeing how they all work together. They even eventually you get a guy who basically just gives you a training mode. So you can go in and actually train and practice combos, and you can turn on hitboxes. This is how fighting game this is. You can turn on hitboxes and like you go into this training mode, and it's just basically like a practice mode from a fighting game. Like you can set how much meter you want, what you want the enemies to do. You can turn hitboxes on so you can see those, so you can work on your combos. It's great and wonderful. And that is really what drives the game for me, is the characters and the world, and the combat. It is just like so fun and enjoyable to play around with. The areas where the game falls a little bit short, I think, are on the in a couple ways. Like on the exploration front, like the exploration is pretty good. Like it is not as tight as like a standard platformer. As you are working through the armor, you do have to do jumping, and there are puzzles, and there are climbing, and like you do get moves to traverse the environment. You get a high jump. You get an axe that lets you basically like claw onto a ledge that might be like a little bit too high for your jump to get you on top of. You can wall jump. You can pogo hop on your spear. All these things for getting around the environment, but like sometimes it's just not as precise as you want it to be. But kind of the weirder thing is the game really feels like it's like dying to break out in like full Metroidvania fashion and have you like very quickly be like re-exploring old areas with your new abilities to like look for items and stuff you forgot. But it really pretty much just keeps you on the main path. Like there's like exploration you can do within the area you're in, but I kept like getting that feeling like, man, it's gonna shoot me back. At any minute now, I'm gonna get the ability to start jumping between areas so I can start collecting all those little red rocks I missed. But it pretty much just keeps you on the straight and narrow, which just felt kind of weird, I guess, really. It just felt like there was like a little bit more they could have done in that direction sooner. The other thing that kind of drives me bonkers is it's a little bit light on information as far as like the stats of your characters. When you get a character, it gives you like kind of a little like, I don't know, it there is a little info sheet on what that character can do, but it doesn't go over everything. It'll say like, okay, well, here are the things to think about for this character. It's like your up attack does this, your special does this, or I guess it's just pointing out what makes them unique, really. So, but it doesn't say like everything that they can do. And each character has like a star rating out of 5 for their speed, their defense, and their attack ability. Defense might be hit points. What might be defense? I don't remember. It's one of those two. I mean, you can see their hit points as a number, so that would be kind of redundant. But you don't like what does that mean? Like, what is this character's actual strength? And when they level up, because characters do level up, like, what are they gaining out of the level up? Is it just more health? It doesn't appear that they're getting more stars on their little rating sheet. They're not learning new abilities. So I just wish there was like raw numbers that I could see going up or compare between, like, to actually get down and be like, well, okay, what character, you know, I want just the like, what actually is this character's strength compared to this one, like on a more granular level?
Yeah.
And they're also like, other than those, you do get like a couple vendors basically that will upgrade your attack or your defense, but there's no, and I'm not saying that every RPG needs to have like shops with equipment or consumable items or whatever, but because of that, so there's not like a lot of progression for anything. There's like just, okay, pour these into this for attack, pour these into this for defense, but there's no like, okay, well, maybe I want to level up this one skill on a character. There's like none of that. There's no, I mean, it's, when you have a few dozen characters, it would be kind of ridiculous to have to manage equipment. So I can see why they didn't do that. But maybe something that you could put get your hand in there to say, well, I want to boost this character up a little bit more, other than just, well, I'm going to use them in battle so they level up, you know? Just a little bit more of customization and like a little bit more information as to just like what everything means, really.
Yeah.
But overall, the game is pretty darn good. And $40, which is these day and age, in my mind, a bit of a budget price. It's not a full $60 release, full $60, whatever that means. And it's not a short game either. I can't tell you exactly how many hours I put into it. Here's something that's fucking annoying. This is a pet peeve of mine across any game that does this, is games that count the hours while your system is in sleep mode as hours played on the game.
No, so, man.
So I have played over 200 hours of Indivisible in the last 2 weeks somehow. I couldn't tell you how many actual hours I've played. Some amount in there. So I have no idea. I've seen that it's somewhere between like 15 and 20 hours in length. So it's not like a short game, but I think it's a lot of fun. I'm pretty happy with it. There was many a night playing it where I did not want to put it down and go to bed, but I did.
And you barely even got to touch on like the visuals and the music and the voice acting.
Oh, it is God. Well, hey, so let well me touch done. On those things. Those things are all well done. Yeah, the graphics look like the animations of the characters look great, as one would expect from Lab Zero. Man, friends of mine would shoot me for not talking about the music of this game. It is done by Mr. Secret of Mana himself. It's Kikuta. What's his name? Hiroko Kikuta. Right?
Yes. I think so.
I'm bad with the Japanese names because, yeah, no, I, yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I got that right. Okay. Yeah. Hiroki, not Kun. Mm. Yeah. Hiroki Kuda. He did the music and it is wonderful music. Like I said, I've had that one song on my PS4, theme playing every time my wife uses the PS4 for years now. And yeah, the voice acting is really good. All the characters, some characters are more voiced than others, because while there is a few dozen characters, not all of them are story integral. So some of them only have like a couple lines, but well, at least they don't have as many lines as the other. Some revolve around the story a lot more than others. But yeah, like Ajna's really good. The production value of this game is very good. All around, like, it looks great, it sounds great, the writing is really good, like, just the characters are all really endearing. Like, I can keep coming back to that. Like, that is the selling point of this game, is those characters and like how unique they are, and using them in battle and seeing them interact. At any point, like, you can jump inside, like I mentioned, they are going like into Ajna's head, your main character's headspace, like this little astral realm in her head. You can go into that, like, it is a physical space you can go into and explore, and like as you get more characters it expands, so you can run around and climb around in there and like see what they're doing and talk to them. They don't have like a ton to say, but it's just more, it's interesting to do every now and then. And that's also where those shopkeepers set up too. Convenient. Once you find that, like, that last gem you need for an upgrade, you don't have to, like, go back to a central area. You can just go inside your head.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, overall, $40, what is your verdict?
Buy it! Buy it! Please buy it. No, it is, you know, it's not a perfect game. It does have some shortcomings, but I feel like what it does right is very good and unique. I think, in the combat system and the way that it uses its characters. But like, it is brain intensive and it does take some getting used to, and, you'll get stomped sometimes. The game is not too bad about, like if you lose a battle, like you don't lose a lot of progress. It just kind of like knocks you back to restart the battle. So it's not mean like that. Which is good probably, because things can get out of hand.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, absolutely, it's a buy for sure.
Awesome. Well, Tim, always a pleasure having you on chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final words before we get onto our party cast?
I do not. Just get this party started. I don't want to end this review as disappointingly as Hell in a Cell.
All right, and we are moving on. We've got ourselves a good old party cast going on. Cole, you're here. Pernell, you're here. Chris, you're here. And even better, Norg, you're here.
You have too much goddamn energy for this late at night.
He's on West Coast.
Still.
Right. It's only 7:07, baby.
That is late at night when you get up at 5 a.m.
I was like, I'm thinking the sun's still probably out over there, and they have their crazy beach and cave customs. I don't know what they get down with those
talking about.
West Coast, man. You guys get down in weird and crazy ways. Yes, right. You know what I'm talking about.
Dude, I'm from near Seattle. The only thing we have is bad coffee and stoic populace.
What? I thought you guys were supposed to be known for great coffee and cave culture.
What but the stoicism negates it, see? All of us who can still feel feelings consider it great coffee.
See, now hang on. What is cave culture and why is it a thing that I don't have? Because I would love to live in a cave. Like an actual literal cave.
Well,
out of the side of a hill.
That would be pretty freaking awesome, though. You got to admit, no tax.
Is that cave culture?
No, that's not cave culture. That's living in a cave. I'm talking about the real stuff, like that unga bunga you were doing. They're like,
caveman person culture.
Yeah.
Oh,
the relax, do what you feel, unga bunga shit. The good stuff.
That unga bunga shit.
Yeah, that's Southern California surfer dude. Shit, that's we don't have any of that nonsense up here.
Nuts, my mistake. Though I gotta say, though, all jokes aside, though, Seattle is, I mean, maybe it's because I was only visiting and I don't live there, but it's honestly one of my favorite cities in the country. It's got a nice aesthetic to it that I don't really get over here below sea level. So
where below sea level are you exactly?
I am in Delaware. There's nothing here. It's bland.
Delaware.
But it is tax-free. I'll give it that. That's about
the home of the second lowest highest point in the United States.
Yes. Yes.
Second lowest highest point.
Correct. Which state has the lowest highest point?
Just pick your pages. Open up your picture page.
I'm going to jump in and guess Atlantis.
Atlantis is A, not a thing, and B, not a state in the United States.
I'm going to call bullshit on the first one. I saw the documentary from Walt Disney.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Gotta find that guy with the glasses. He knows the answers.
All right, so Atlantis is not the correct answer. Joe, is that your final answer?
Is Atlanta?
Atlanta is not a state, and it is not the lowest highest point. Cole.
Atlantic Prime.
Say what?
Yeah, Atlantic Prime. It's an experimental state, but it's the real deal.
Oh, Jesus.
State of the Union, not of mind.
Damn, now I'm stumped.
Aw.
The answer is Florida. With New Mexico. Oh, I was going to go with New Mexico.
I'm going to end the torture now.
What was the answer?
The answer was Florida.
See, my last guess was going to be Jesus, but...
Is that because it's the lowest on the continental?
Well, it's Florida's highest altitude is the lowest high altitude in the United States. The lowest highest point.
Florida have altitude? Like, I thought the whole thing was below sea level at this point.
You would think so. There must be at least one part of it that's a couple feet above, maybe.
At the very least, the whole state is drowning in old people and meth heads.
Well, and gators.
And hurricanes. Gators.
Don't worry, Florida man will save it.
Florida man. Number of those.
Florida man.
Honestly, I like Orlando. I've been there like twice. And I don't know if I'd want to live there. Wait, is that what it sounds like in Seattle? Just cricket town?
Pretty much. Actually, there's a really loud frog in my backyard, and I can't find him. I want to meet the frog that can croak that loud. It's amazing. I can hear him with all the windows closed.
Well, I got an idea for you. What you need to do is get yourself a pig. Uh-huh. Now, it doesn't have to be a particular pig. You just need to have a dress. And you put it in the backyard and possibly leave a mojito next to it and go to bed. And when you wake up, the frog and the pig will be having a nice conversation, possibly drunk, and you'll have your answers then.
I was going to say, I swear, I thought you were leading into a Sarah Palin joke right there.
Oh, God.
Because, like, you said pig, and then it went to mojito, and I'm like, oh, here it comes! Here it comes! I can see Russia from here! Here we go!
God! I didn't even know that was a thing that could tie to her. But that just makes it better.
Oh, you don't remember the lipstick on the pig thing with her?
Yeah,
Cole knows where it's at.
I remember the Russia from my house bit, but not the lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was like, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
Yeah, but it'll be a much sexier pig.
You can put lipstick on Sarah Palin, but she's still Sarah Palin. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, Sarah Palin was an odd case, a very, very odd case. But I don't know. I think looking back on her, it was a lot of humor. It's just funny looking back on it. At the time, though, it was kind of sad. Though I will admit, it generated one of my favorite little memes of Abraham Simpson and Maude Flanders running for president and vice president. Oh. That was pleasant.
That was a good one.
It was.
It was kind of a dark comedy, now that we look back on it. I mean, really.
Oh, yeah. But some of the best comedies are the dark variety, so I can't fault it. Well, I can, but I don't want to. It was chuckle-worthy.
It was stand-up tragedy.
Yes. Ashley is being so loud behind me, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Hi, Ashley!
Everyone says hi, Ashley.
We love you!
She's taking the trash out.
Dude.
What a good egg.
A good woman right there.
She is a good woman.
I mean, I guess she beat all those guys up by herself, and is that what's going on?
How many meth heads does she have to beat up in order to get to the garbage can?
Trying to take out the trash. Damn,
thankfully, none. She just has to get past the whole, like, an obstacle course full of kittens.
Well, that's not going to happen. She's going to be laid out there petting the cats. Trash is going to be just stinking it up.
Pretty much. But at least she doesn't have to do battle with meth heads. Putting on gear.
Unless they get wind of
their
being. If they get wind of those kittens, though, she might have a battle on her hands. So just prepare yourself.
Yow.
Oh, man. On that note, should we dive into reviews? There are a lot of games that we have to talk about. Everybody here has something to talk about, so it's going to be a long one.
Yeah!
I'm terrified of the length, but let's see. It's all about how to use it anyway, so let's just get through it.
Is everyone
Welcome
ready to
the
get
SML
going?
Podcast. We bring you length and girth.
And even
a little self-worth.
A little bit of self-worth. We are a girthy podcast.
Self-abuse is the sincerest kind.
Yes. Yes, it is. Is someone else doing laundry, too?
I have no idea what's going on in someone's background.
Everyone's doing laundry.
Not it. I'm just sitting here patiently.
I'm not doing any laundry.
What
I'm
you're
just
saying is
some fat ass to call on me.
Herbert!
Get your fat ass back here. Looks like the good Lord brought us a present. Jesse!
Oh, love that voice.
Da, 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 da. I got some popsicles down in the basement. You boys sell truck to phase the tune.
Anyway.
Oh my god. On that note, first game that we're here to talk about is called Ni No Kuni Wrath of the White Witch, developed by Level 5, published by Bandai Namco, released September 20th on the Switch for $49.99. Ni No Kuni Remastered released the same day on the PS4 for $49.99 as well. Join Oliver as he embarks on an adventure through a world inhabited by new friends and ferocious foes alike in hopes of bringing back his mother after a tragic incident. With a copy of The Wizard's Companion and his friend Drippy by his side, he will travel across this rich fantasy world to tame familiars, take on enemies, and overcome the countless challenges that stand between him and his mother's salvation. George, tell us about Ni No Kuni.
Did you say taint familiars?
Tame.
Tame!
Tame, oh. Yes. Tame okay. Familiars.
Okay, I had to make sure because that was not my gaming experience with with this particular game. I love that they named the kid Oliver because he's a kid and he's Oliver. And every time he starts talking, I keep expecting, pardon me, sir, can I have some more? Because it's Oliver and Oliver's great.
Who will buy this wonderful morning?
You know.
Wait a Oliver. Minute. Are these sound clips or are you just that damn good?
I'm just wiggity whack, you know?
He is.
Oh boy, the publisher's gonna hate us for this review. Hi guys, it's a pleasure to review this game for you. Oh my goodness, Ni No Kuni was the best thing I've played in the last 6 months. Oh man. Okay, so for full disclosure, by the way, I actually gave up the opportunity to start the new Dragon Quest game when it came out just to do this, and I was super excited to do it because Joe told me about it, and I pulled up a preview, and it looked like I was watching My Neighbor Totoro again. And he said, yeah, it's animated by the same people. I was like, I'll do it. So here we are. It's like playing one of their movies. It's so much fun. And I'm completely biased because I love all of those movies. But it's a great mix of full cutscenes and transitions back and forth between in-game engine to the cutscenes to actually moving around and doing stuff. But you very rarely ever feel like you lost the feeling of being in there. It's extremely immersive. And it was a tremendous amount of fun to finally get a chance to play through that. So I'm going to start with the only ugly moment that came out of this game, which was occasional crashing.
Yeah, I think you like to grade things on good, bad, and ugly.
Good, bad, and ugly. I will start with the ugly. There were a couple of crashes in the time that I was playing it. That was it. I have played more expensive games that crashed more, so I feel like the bar is low at this point. I'm pretty sure we're looking at EA somewhere in there. But yeah, the only a couple of crashes, and then that's the end of my ugly category, because everything just kind of floated to the top on this one. I'm going to skip straight to the bad and get it out of the way so that I can continue to gush. The combat system did get a little tedious after a while. At the beginning, it was fun. The animations are cute. There's a lot to take in when the combat is happening. And as the game progresses on, there are new elements like countering when you hit the attack button at exactly the right time, or certain creatures can evade and block attacks entirely, and that can tremendously improve your life expectancy chances. The familiars that you tame, not taint, are a little bit on the overpowered side, it seems. And I know that you can collect plenty more of them, and there are evolutions and such to that, but I have to ask, and maybe this is just the non-completionist OCD person in me, I'm not sure what the point is, other than possibly just for the sake of collection and completionism, which is actually probably okay.
Yeah, gotta catch them all.
Gotta catch them. Where have we heard that before? That's a familiar catchphrase.
Pretty sure it was Red Dead Redemption 2.
No, when you catch them all in Red Dead Redemption 2, it's syphilis. That's
It was Bassett's Black Bass with Mark Davis.
Or maybe it was dysentery. Oh, dude. Later, we got to talk about Blue Marlin and how awesome fishing games are. But that's neither here nor now.
How did that come from dysentery?
Because you go straight to dysentery from syphilis. It's like the chain of command. Anyway, moving on. The game, and this is kind of a medium, not bad, not good. It feels very, well, no. First of all, there was a lot of hand-holding to get through the actual beginning plot points. And that started to get tedious for a while, but I'm an adult. So that brings me to my next point. This feels like it was geared for a younger audience. This is neither good nor bad. However, it's the cost of the game, I think, might be a little bit on the high side if the younger audience was the target appeal in this case. So having said all that, let's get to the more fun aspects of it. The artwork is gorgeous. In-game, cutscenes, overworld, towns, townspeople, the actual user interface. Everything is gorgeous. It obviously borrows from other types of games, and or at least in terms of style. There's a lot of FedExing that goes on in this. There is a lot of, I lost my ring in the pot, and I have to get somebody to find it, and I've looked everywhere, and I can't find it. So then you go and you find the ring, and you bring it back, and they give you stamps in your stamp card, which is a really cute way of accumulating stamp cards. Once you've accumulated stamp cards, you can use them to buy things. We'll come back to buying things in just a second. The cutscenes are beautiful. They're animated amazingly. The frame rates are beautiful. Everything about the cutscenes is just awesome. It's like watching another one of their animated movies, and I could watch that all day. The music is beautiful. Absolutely no question about it. I could listen to the music all day long and not be in the game. It's full, it's appropriate at all the appropriate places, and it does not at any point disappoint in any way, shape, or form. The voice acting was really good. It was a little bit on the quirky side at times, but it was extremely earnest and so well done and entirely convincing. Exploration is actually a lot of fun when you're not stuck in the parts where it's kind of guiding and hand-holding you through the plot points. There's enough overworld exploration just to kind of wander around and look for random encounters that you get to really fully experience all of the types of artwork that are available, that obviously a ton of time was put into this. The spell system that your character, Oliver the Wizard, can I have some more, is very unique. Because instead of just your generic fireball, which you have the generic fireball, you also have a couple of very oddly specific spells, like Gateway takes you back and forth between a couple of different worlds. Unlock will sometimes unlock certain chests and doors if the wand you have is powerful enough. The growth spell will make mushrooms grow faster so you can jump on them. Again, very oddly specific. But one of the mechanics of the spells is it kind of forces you to wander around and look for people who can allow you to use certain spells to acquire items you need to help other people in the game to feel better. I don't want to give away too much on that because that's a huge component of something you learn while you're in the game and kind of the whole point of it as you go on and discover the nefariousness of the evil person's white witch. I want to divert back to the evil woman who, again, has an amazing voice, and the art direction for her is the craziest thing. The outside of this cloak that she wears is a solid color, but when you see her open her cloak, the inside of the cloak looks like all of the vastness of the universe and the galaxies and the stars. And it doesn't move in the same way as everything else around her. It's almost like it's static. It's gorgeous. I want to see quite a bit more of that. The familiars, untainted, are fun. You can equip them with weapons and items and patches and objects to improve their stats, but you can also feed them with certain items that will increase their base stats, and they make the cutest sounds and noises when you feed them. It's almost overwhelming how adorable some of the sounds they make are. The gameplay itself is relatively simple, but it works in the overall context of the game. And again, I'm kind of taking this with the grain of salt that maybe the target audience is a little bit younger and not as intense JRPG as some of the rest of us old fart nerds. The combat system is kind of real time, kind of turn-based, with a lot of elements to try to keep track of. There are certain familiars that work better against certain enemies than others. Some familiars are better at evading attacks. Some are just plain stronger. Some are better with magic than others. And your own character can actually get involved in the skirmish. The good news, or bad, depending on how you want to look at it, is there's one hit point pool and one magic point pool for everybody. You and all of your familiars share all that. So if your familiar takes damage, then you as the character take that damage. You can switch back and forth between familiars and the main Oliver character at almost any time during combat, And that's a pretty good tactical strategy, depending on what it is that you're fighting against. There are plenty of opportunities to cast a variety of different in-combat spells, some of which are unique as far as skills go to each familiar, and some are really effective in some situations, and some are completely wrong to even try in a given situation. So there's a huge amount of lore to learn about just the combat system. Even though the combat system does get tedious after a while, and I find myself mashing the A button at the end of each combat so that I can kind of get on with other things, the music and the sound effects and everything really make it fun to experience. And all of the animated creatures, the bad guys, the familiars, the fairies and everything, it's just so much fun to watch. I'm sure at some point in my jaded oldness, I would probably, it would get old after a while, but at this point it hasn't. And this is probably going to be one of the few that Joe has given me that I will probably continue to play to completion, because I'm excited to see where this story goes.
It goes to very strange, awesome to hear. Wonderful places.
Strange and wonderful places. Oh, the places you will go.
Like the bar. Because like, you know, Oliver turns 21 in the game and gets right ripper.
Wow.
That's Ni No Kuni 3.
That's Ni No Hell No Kuni.
3 No Kuni.
He just been through a lot. I think he deserves a beer. I'm just saying. A
beer. Hey, Oliver, are you ready for that stiff shot?
But I don't know what a shot is. I thought that came out of a gun. Holy shit.
I'm a man now.
Oh,
get
my Lord.
Get the spell book out of here. Time to go to work.
That's why you never deceive.
Oh, oh man. Well, George, $50 on Ni No Kuni on the Switch. What do you think of it?
Oh, you got to get this game. You've got to get this game. It, unless you're old and jaded, you've got to get this game. I loved every second of it. Even with the crashes and a bit of the tedium, it's absolutely worth having in the library and enjoying. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yay!
All right. Well, are you going to stick around or are you heading out?
You know what? I think I'm going to head out. I'm going to kiss my children goodnight because it's their bedtime out here on the West Coast in cave culture.
Cave time.
All right. Well, George.
Oh, ooga baga, ooga baga, ooga baga.
That's the cave culture I'm talking about.
Captain. Yay! Yeah.
And son.
Oh, geez. George, it is always a pleasure having you on the show. Do you have any final words before we let you go?
I think I thrashed it with Captain Caveman there. We're good.
All right. You take care of yourself, George.
You too. Love you all. Hugs and kisses.
Bye, pancakes.
Ew.
All right. Well, moving on. Next game to talk about is called Code Vein, developed and published by Bandai Namco, released September 27th on Xbox One, PS4, and PC for $59.99. In the face of certain death, we rise, team up, and embark on a journey that ends to the ends of hell to unlock your past and escape your living nightmare in Code Vein. Purnell, tell us about Code Vein.
Man, I can't follow that guy. That was just masterful. Christ. Well, I'm going to do a, well, it'll be much blander, but nonetheless, I will give it my pep. So Code Vein is a game where you basically fill the role of, I don't want to call them an adventurer because I don't think you're on an adventure so much as you're kind of on a forced excursion, but, you live in a world where let's just call it an apocalypse of sorts has occurred, which resulted in a number of people, pretty much everyone, becoming these beings called revenants, which are essentially zombies, but without zombie property. So they're basically human visually, but they crave blood. And if they don't get blood, they become something called the Lost, which are these like abominations. They start out just kind of like wild, angry people, but then they become monsters and creep shows and whatever. And your main character has been dropped into this world with no memory of who they are, you know, typical amnesia plot, blah, blah, blah. And you end up on a whirlwind of an adventure, joining up with a group of, you know, remaining revenants who are trying to prevent becoming lost while also figuring out if there's a way to reverse their predicament and become normal humans again. Now, of course, this world also has this weird problem where blood comes from seeds from trees somehow, and those trees are drying up. But the MacGuffin that makes your character special, or one of the two, the other I'll get into, is that your main character is able to revive these blood trees, thereby making it so people can last longer. It gives them the ability to venture further into their world to find solutions to their plight. There's a whole plot around that too, but I'm not going to get into that. So, how does the game itself play them? Well, the way I'd like to describe it, it's Dark Souls in gameplay style, but with a number of positive changes. And though this could go either way for a lot of players, I feel like it has more outward personality than Dark Souls had, which is I thought was a good thing. So for those who aren't familiar, or maybe familiar, I don't know, Dark Souls is a very foreboding environment. Every Dark Souls game is very foreboding. Dark atmosphere, everything sucks here, and it's a very brutal action RPG combat system. And this game, well, it has the foreboding atmosphere and the dark, heavy action RPG combat, but the reason why it has more personality in that sense is that you come across a number of individuals from the very start that all communicate with you regularly, and they even team up with you on excursions when you go out into the world. So combat consists of a light attack and a heavy attack, which can be used with different weapons to generate different attacks. You can also charge up your heavy attack to do a super move. You also have something called a blood code. The blood code is something that every revenant gets that is basically another word for a class, a character class. It denotes your base stats. It denotes what abilities you can get. And unlike every other revenant who can only have one blood code, you can have a plethora of them. As many as you can get access. You knew I was going to say it. You knew it.
I love that word.
It's such a great word.
That means a lot. Thanks, Pernell. That means a lot.
You get a whole plethora of blood codes depending on if you can acquire them. They come in the form of something called a vestige, which is essentially a crystal that falls from the ground from a person or whatever. Typically a person who's gone lost. But what ends up happening is when you get these vestiges and you acquire new blood codes, you are, whereas in, like, say, a Dark Souls game, class is really only your starting stats in those games. In this game, your class can be changed on the fly, and it has very real repercussions as you play the game, which I personally think is awesome. So, for starters, when you change blood codes, you get a different set of skills that you can equip. And your base stats change, which determines what stuff you can equip. So, for example, you might have a warrior-type blood code, which will allow you to use heavier weapons, have higher stamina, whatever. But if you switch to, like the ranger-type blood code, you're meant to be nimble and quick. So now, all of a sudden, you can't hold that heavy broadsword. You got to switch to something light, like a bayonet, and fire bullets, and air dash all over the freaking place. But While you can't transfer the base stats between blood codes, I like the way this game is designed in that you can master the skills that each blood code has, whether through fighting or fulfilling whatever condition the game tells you to master that blood code, or you can spend resources to just master it on the side. But once you've done so, you can use those skills across any blood code you want. So you can kind of mix and match skills between all the different character classes and make a super character that denotes the kind of playstyle you want to run with in your gameplay environment. Now, I love that aspect of the game. I thought it was a great time, and I've been enjoying utilizing it to just kind of have my own little super character. Of course, in order to truly get the most out of it, you got to suffer. You got to suffer a lot because the game is not easy. I will admit, if you've played Souls-esque games in the past, you will come into this game better prepared than the average person because you're already familiar with getting your ass beat repeatedly to get success. Whereas in this game, same thing, and if you're not used to it, which you might not be if you come into it because it has the anime aesthetic, which Dark Souls does not, which is may draw in a different crowd.
Yeah, like Dark Mika in chat says, it's anime Dark Souls of cuteness.
Yeah, there is some cuteness in here. Though I gotta admit, though, thanks to the character creator, which is freaking immaculate, you can go cute or rugged. is your choice, though I'll admit. You have to give your character a number of scars to truly get rugged. I think even the most hardened character looks still anime cutish. but I honestly like that too. I like the fact that whereas in, you know, Dark Souls, if you want to get cosmetic and creative, you got to go with the Fashion Souls route, which usually means you're going to trade, you know, efficient character builds for a tiara and a gold dress and a giant gauntlet. In this game, your aesthetic has nothing to do with your stats, which I think is amazing. I prefer that, honestly. And it starts you off with so many freaking options to just throw your awesome character build together visually. And then when you're done, you go into the world and you do your character build up. So now you can have this character. Like, my character had a halo and a freaking coffin on her back and a hat with the crown on top of it, with the halo on top of that. I got stupid with my character build, and it was freaking awesome. Chains everywhere. You'd think Tetsuya Nomura was involved with my character construction. Zipper, zipper. But, I mean, the game is fantastic. And there's also what I like about it. Like, aside from the usual world layout that the game has, well, actually, I should mention this too beforehand. All the characters that I mentioned before, how I mentioned that you can kind of have them go with you in combat once you meet them or whatever. I like the fact that when you take a character with you, aside from the fact that they have their own character class and they act in their own special way, because you don't tell them what to do. They do what they're going to do. I also like that depending on who you take with you, they provide an additional skill you can equip. You can't learn this skill through traditional means, but it means that when you have that person with you, you have access to one new ability that you wouldn't have otherwise. And you might come across a guy that you like whose personality is awesome, but in addition to that, they also give you this really cool melee attack that you don't want to do without. So you're just going to take them with you every time you go out into the world or whatever. So let me think here. Aside from that, there is some, actually, this is different from Dark Souls 2. There's another element that I kind of like about the game, whereas aside from the usual exploring the world bit, there's this environment called the Depths. And what the Depths are is a series of, I'll just say, like mazes you can unlock by finding maps out in the world, usually through NPCs or possibly from like on the ground or in treasure chests. But you take them back to the main hub, and there's a guy there where upon handing him a map, he will let you explore the Depths at a certain level, which allows you to find treasure, fight some bosses, though I admit are usually reskins of former bosses. It's still kind of a nice, you know, run-through scenario. Though, one thing I noticed was happening that I don't know what triggered it since I was playing it offline, though I'm assuming it was probably trying to simulate an online thing, was while I'm running around in this place, at one point, the game just said, "Lost Invasion," and all of a sudden I got, like, sworn by a freaking load of enemies.
That, oh, shit.
Felt like they would never stop coming, and I'm honestly surprised I survived it, because thankfully I guess the skills really paid off if I utilized those bad boys. Oh, crap. And I'm glad I just thought about this. I have to mention one really important element of gameplay, and that is how the quote-unquote magic system works. So remember how I mentioned that every class has a variety of different skills to it? Well, all of those skills, or most of those skills, typically require use of, I guess, Ecor, I-C-H-O-R, Ecor, whatever. Just think of it as MP, all right? They all require MP to use. Now, in traditional games, you have, you know, your MP gauge, and then you can use Ether to regain MP or whatever. But this game's a little different. The way it works is every class has its own different MP max startout. Could be 5, could be 10, could be 30, could be more. And that is what it is. And as you use spells, it will decrease. However, a way that you can get those skills back is by using drain attacks. It's a special type of attack you can do. Usually drains your entire stamina gauge when you pull it off, unless you hit a backstab on a guy, which is kind of like an instant use of it. But what happens is when you do it, it not only gives you some of that MP back, it also increases your max MP unless you kind of further and build up your character to do more skills and play around more. Now, when you stop at a missile, M-I-S-T-L-E, which is pretty much what a bonfire is in Dark Souls. When you do that, it will reset that back to your default missile, your default MP. So it's kind of an incentive for you to not just kind of kill two guys and go rest at the missile, and you kill two more guys and rest at the missile, because aside from enemies just respawning, you also lose that, you know, MP boost. So I actually kind of like that element of the game and maybe focus more on trying to like get a good combo in and just like knock the guy down with my little claw hand and drain his MP out of him like a little walking vampire person. Also, there's a hot tub, which is interesting. It lets you when you go to the hot tub, it allows you to replay memories. Those memories being story beats that occurred and see like old, like cinemas play out again and kind of lets you get caught back up on where you left off. So it's good for like, if you put the game down for a bit and come back, it's just nice to be like, hey, I'm gonna go take a soak in the hot tub, figure out where the hell I left off in this freaking game. It's honestly, I think the game is great. I mean, I looked around because I was curious about what some other people thought of it. And I've seen people that like, kind of rag on it, like it's got boobs and whatever. And honestly, I thought that was a whole load of crap. Like, there's some bustiness in there, but it's not like, you know, there's no nudity. It's just this character is endowed or something, whatever. I don't care. The game itself doesn't really drive that home. It's just, here's a world with a bunch of characters in it. It's your choice if you want to oogle that stuff or not. But as far as the actual characters go and the world they built and the dialogue and the gameplay, I feel as though they made a pretty awesome package. They did a great job with this game. And I have been enjoying it and will continue to enjoy it. Though I will be getting my ass beat as I do, I will be doing that in a great way. This is a great game. And it definitely comes highly recommended. And personally, I feel as though this is a nice shakeup. I felt the Souls style of game. I just call it Souls because that's kind of, it really is that. It's a nice shakeup for the Souls concept of gameplay. It's different enough to make you feel like you're playing that level of challenging action RPG, but you're not playing the same old game. Now I'm hoping that someone else comes along and makes a game that brutally tough, but it's like raises hell where everything's cute and cuddly and very painful. It will be freaking awesome. If anyone's listening, please, please do that. I would play it.
Dark Mika is asking what the last place you got to in the game was.
Let me see. Honestly, I just went down to like depths level 3. So there's like one depths level. Then you go into like this freaking like city area where you have to kind of, you meet a guy, he sells you a bunch of like random like pennants and stuff, which you can then trade into a bunch of other people to get them to give you gear, which will allow you to boost your weapons kind of like construction wise and then go out into the world that way. So I pretty much just played around with that for a bit. Just died a lot.
Dying is fun.
Yes, it's very fun. But the downside to dying a lot, well, actually not really the downside, the good side to dying a lot is that it results in you honestly just building your dude up more. I had a bad habit of like, okay, I'm just going to keep doing this. I'm going to get used to this character class. Okay, get used to this character class. Okay, now I got 3 more character classes. That's freaking awesome. And they each have their own. Oh, I forgot to mention too. When you get some of the character classes, they start out with some abilities, but not all of their abilities. And you have to unlock additional abilities by finding like additional memories for that character and unlocking their memories, which is an odd tangent, but whatever. The end result is you get more access, you get access to more skills within that blood code. So this is nice.
All right. Well, overall, $60. What do you say?
I think it's 100% fun and worth that money. Mainly if you like those kinds of games, though. Like if you're coming to this and you don't like games that will challenge you, but all you see is the anime, then it's more of a try it. But if you're okay with getting your ass beat a little bit, it is totally worth the fun time.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Indeedly.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Stellatum, developed by Satyr Entertainment, published by Sometimes You, released October 9th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $14.99. You are playing for an extraterrestrial race that has become ready to conquer outer space. Whole story begins with the fact that you are going to destroy a comet that threatens your planet. An unforeseen event happened that dragged you into the midst of the battles, but everything may not be what it seems. Chris, tell us about this game.
I thought I knew about this game until I heard that description. That's so confusing. Well, like, the game doesn't really give you a whole lot of clues as to what's going on, but it's, you know, you go into a level and you start shooting things, and then everything's fine. So I was kind of not worried about it. But yeah, apparently there's a big comet, they say?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I did remember them mentioning that at some point. So, Stellatum.
I don't know how to say it.
I was saying Stellatum, but I knew that was wrong. I just like to say it because it sounds like skeleton. yeah, so Stellatum is a... so what this is actually kind of a, I'm going to say a rare bird, even on the shmup-laden Switch. Now, shmup, if you didn't know, is a shoot 'em up where you play as one ship against many ships, often shooting many bullets, a multitude of them that you have to dodge. And then, you know, you fire your own weapon, whereupon, if you are lucky and or persistent, you will destroy all the ships, as outlined by the game Beaker Reloaded on the Switch. I think I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, but if you start the game Beaker Reloaded on the Switch, which is a B-based shmup, they spend a lot of time unskippably explaining what a shmup is to you. So now every time I think about it, I think about that description. Anyways, so this one though is in rare form for this particular genre, in that it is a top-down vertical shooter. However, it is also a twin-stick shooter. So, of course, a twin-stick shooter is something akin to, you know, like a standard vertical shooter, if you think all the way back, is like a Space Invaders or like Galaga type of game. You know, where you move your ship is static, facing the same direction all the time, you shoot forward. A twin-stick shooter, of course, is like Asteroids, where you rotate the ship while you're moving it, and then, you know, you move it in a direction, and then you, like, turn the gun towards something, and then shoot it, both in real time. So this is that, but the stages actually scroll, so it's not like a single screen or an exploration-based thing. Like, all the twin-stick shooters I've played on Switch so far have been exploration-based. This one is still vertically scrolling, but you're actually basically spinning your ship around like a hockey puck all across the screen while enemies come at you in the normal way. Funny enough, when you start this game, you have like this really cool like quadruple type shot thing. You have missiles coming out, like seeking out the enemies. You know, you have a shield that you can command. You can push the L button for a nice charged up laser, and you know, all kinds of knickknacks and paddywhacks. And then you beat the first level, and then things happen, and your ship is reduced to one little pew pew laser that you get. And then you find out what the real meat of this game is, and that is customizing. This is a game about collecting resources from these stages, and then using those resources in the ship's massive customization in-game menu to purchase, customize, and build new parts for your ship, so that you can eventually build your way back up to that ship that you got to so luxuriously use in the first tutorial stage. And so there's, you know, it's a space shooter, so there's not a ton of variety. Everything happens against a really cool, like, space background with those nice cloudy galaxies in the background. Sometimes there will be, like, a space station where, you know, might remind you of, Star Soldier or... you know, just one of those where, like, you know, this giant metal thing that you're just, like, flying over and, like, shooting at pods and things like that. That happens sometimes. And all in all, like, you get this nice little star field representation of the whole game, presumably that's the whole game. I obviously haven't gotten through all of them. There's about 60 of them in view as you start the game. So plenty of places to go to. And, of course, you can branch out and, you know, connect the dots, essentially, you know, like, draw lines between them however you like. And yeah, really, I mean, at the end of the day, it just comes down to basically either playing or repeating stages and trying to collect those resources and then going and buying those items and then hopping back in even stronger than before and building it back up so that you can get to the end. Simple as that. And yeah, like, you know, the only real complaint I have about it is that you know, and I've said this before about some games, but man, when you're making a game on the Switch, don't make the text so small.
Yeah, if somebody that seems wants, like, a problem with a lot of games on Switch.
Yeah, I mean, not a huge amount of them, and some games handle it so beautifully that I just really have to commend them. This is not one of those games. The text is nigh unreadable in portable mode, and that's a problem when it comes to an actual, like, articulate, like, multi-sentence description of something that you're trying to save up enough items to purchase, and you can't even see how many items you have. You have to squint just to see that. Yeah. And I mean, it's compounded by the fact that every menu is done in that same static space background. So if there happens to be, like, let's say some white from some stars, that will blend in with the white text that is being splayed across the screen. So the game is extremely fun to play, extremely painful to read. Fortunately, you don't have to do a whole lot of that. Like, by the time you really get into, like, the nitty-gritty with the items and stuff like that, you just start to get a feel for it, and then, you know, you do just fine. But initially, when you're trying to actually learn about the ins and outs and what you're supposed to do, you're like, get your phone! And then, you know, you want to hook it up onto, like, you know, you want to, like, put it on, like, this giant, like, 120-inch screen display and, like, you know, zoom and enhance and all this other stuff. It's just, like, you know, a problem that easily could have been fixed by them just making the text a little bit bigger. There's plenty of room for stuff, so yeah. I don't know. Apart from that, game, super fun to play, looks and sounds great, and is a very interesting concept.
Well, then $15, what do you say?
Yeah, $15, I would have bought this if I wasn't reviewing it, so I'd say it's worth getting. I mean, you know, $15 is in that range of, like, just an average shooter on the Switch. I mean, obviously you can get into something like Ikaruga for that price, and if your thing is more straightforward action and bullet hell type stuff, then that's what to go for. Obviously, the twin stick shooter aspect of this creates a bit more of a controlling problem, especially at first. You know, obviously you can buy things to make your ship handle better, but you're always going to have that imprecision that some shmup fans really hate. So you have to make sure that, like, this is the kind of game for you. I'd recommend watching a gameplay video or something, because it is not a standard bullet hell. This is very different, but I think that is executed very well and definitely worth $15.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Next game to talk about is called Trine 4, The Nightmare Prince, developed by Frozen Byte, published by Modus Games, released October 8th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $29.99. The Trine Ultimate Collection is also available for $49.99 and includes Trine 4, as well as enhanced ports of Trine 1, 2, and 3. Prince Celius suffers from an intensely dark dreams, and due to the lack of control of his magical talents, monstrous nightmares are able to slip into reality and wreak havoc on the waking world. Amadeus, Pontius, and Zoya must find the afflicted prince and resolve the desperate situation before the world is engulfed by the Nightmare Prince's shadows. Cole, tell us about Trine 4.
So, Trine 4, if you have not played Trine 1 through 3, you are going to be fine playing 4. I couldn't tell you Trine 1 through 3's story to save myself, and it had no bearing whatsoever on my playthrough of 4. Additionally, I can't tell you a whole lot about 4's story, because unfortunately, even though I had subtitles on, the subtitles didn't work. And so, I think I've mentioned before, but I struggle with hearing in my right ear.
Yeah.
And I was having a hard time, like, keeping up with the story and what was happening to it, to the point that, like, I had to go Google it to know what was going on, because I was very confused. Fortunately, it's a 2D puzzle platformer, and the story's just kind of there. It's not overwhelming. You can get by without it. If I hadn't gone and Googled it, I'd have been like, yeah, I still know what's going on. I move boxes. It's fine. Sometimes that's all you need out of a game. You're just like, I don't even care about all the premise of it. I just want to move some goddamn boxes. Let's go. And if that's your case, Trine 4's for you. Like, you can totally get by without all the nitty gritty details. It is a beautiful fairy tale world, with all of your classic fairy tale type of characters. You got the prince who sends everybody on a wild goose chase because he's some kind of jackass who had a nightmare, and here you are. You have a knight. Pontius is a knight. He's your good old-fashioned chunky dude. He's got a sword and a shield, and he's basically who you're going to rely on whenever enemies pop up, which isn't often. It is a puzzle platformer. Combat is really rare, but there are a handful of boss battles. Also, he has a butt slam. They don't call it a butt slam. I forget the specific term they use for it.
It's a butt slam.
He just jumps up and falls down and busts shit. It's a butt slam. it's very useful. You also play as Zora the Thief, and she is your quintessential thief-type character. She has arrows. She has ropes. She can climb to unreachable areas. She's pretty handy. If I had to pick a favorite without even like being able to follow the story properly, she'd be it. in fact, any opportunity to use her over the others, I did, just because I could. You also have the wizard. I already said the knight, sorry. The wizard, and basically his ability is that he can levitate shit around. You're going to be moving boxes. You're going to be moving crates. You're going to be moving boulders. If you need to move it, he's your dude. Very handy. The game does have local multiplayer. So if you want to have somebody help you get through the puzzles, hey, you can do that. But it also plays incredibly well in solo. This is where it's hit or miss, like for a lot of these kind of games. When they're made with multiplayer, they're often made with multiplayer in mind.
Yeah.
And some of the puzzles will get to a point where you're like, I can't fucking do that alone. but Trine 4 does an incredibly good job of not having that problem. You can switch between the characters dynamically with LB and RB. So it's really easy to set up a situation, say, put the boxes in a certain order, and then come back with the thief and tie them together, and then go back with the knight and butt slam something, and just in whatever order you need it to. Another area where those puzzles shine is that even though, you know, multiplayer is an option and you can play it solo, I just completely lost my train of thought. It just, phew!
Damn it, Purnell.
Wait, what did I do?
Because I'm thinking about the laundry he didn't wash.
Hey, don't blame me. Do your own laundry. I'm a big man. My clothes take days to clean.
But when you're able to swap between the characters and everything and play solo, the puzzles have more than one way to approach them. Because of the way that each character interacts with the world in multiple ways, you can usually find ways to get around a puzzle even without using the primary character that the puzzle was intended for. For example, the knight uses his shield to reflect light and water, or there was something else. Light and water are the two that you most frequently encounter that you'll be reflecting. Arrows,
projectiles.
Yeah. But for the sake of the puzzles, there's usually not combat is self-contained, and like you'll get into an area where there'll be a short little phase of combat and then you move on to more puzzles. But you may be in an area where you think that you need to use the knight to move water, but you could also just as effectively use the thief with her elemental arrows and freeze where the water's coming from and effectively do the same thing. So there's almost always a multitude of ways to approach the puzzles. Some of them I thought were funny because you could look at them and tell that there was supposed to be an intricate answer, and I would just be super cheap and cheese it. Because one of the abilities that it gives you is the thief can tie a rope to blocks that are summoned by the wizard. So I would see this great big intricate puzzle and I'd be like, And then I would just use the wizard, summon a block, put it at the end of the puzzle and throw a rope at it and climb up to it. Yeah, fuck your puzzle, bitch, I'm gone.
I'm sure developers love puzzles. Fuck your puzzle, this is how I'm going to do.
But that's the great thing about it. Like, I could have spent 20 minutes, you know, moving shit where they wanted it, or I could just find my own way around.
Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of trying, getting to do mm-hmm. it the way you want to do it.
And there's something very nice about experiencing, realizing that, like, wait a minute, I'm almost positive that's not what they wanted me to do.
Oh, yeah. No, like, every time I would do it super easy, I would stop and look back and be like, oh, I see the hooks I was supposed to use. I ain't need those. It's fine. But you also want to be careful, because if you're flying through like that, you may miss the XP elixirs, because they're hidden in different areas that, you know, sometimes you may need to break down a certain wall to figure out where they are to gain access to them. And you need those XP elixirs to get your power-ups so that the game just doesn't absolutely fuck you in the face later on. For most of my experience with the game, it's been incredibly straightforward. I am playing it on normal. There is a harder difficulty, but fuck that. I have no patience, so here we are. But you can, because it's 2D, even though, like, the areas are kind of obscure or whatever, like, if you sit in an area for a few seconds and just kind of look at it before you move on, you'd be like, oh yeah, I see where that's at. I can figure out that there's some secrets here. So there's achievements for getting all of the XP elixirs and the secret collectibles in every world. And, like, even without going back and replaying, which you can do, but even without going back, I've been getting all of the elixirs. And I was like, this is fine. Most of the puzzles, and again, I love that they can be just completely overruled if you want to. But I love that they can be beaten in multiple ways, but they're incredibly creative because of that. To create puzzles that have to be solved by one of three characters or a combination of those three characters, and then turn around and make it to where somebody can do it alone with any combination of the three characters that they feel like using is impressive, especially given how many levels there are. And how many puzzles are per level.
Yeah.
So that's really creative. It's really well done. And they definitely deserve high remarks on that. The only thing that kind of got me about the game, and it's even as it is, it's kind of just a minor gripe, but the combat and the boss battles, they become a little monotonous after a while. You're just like, yeah, I get it. I walked in a room. Now everything's purple. I'm going to butt slam some shit and I'm gonna go. I was a little disappointed that even though, like I said, the thief has her arrows and you can eventually get a levitation slam for the wizard so that he can throw his boxes, still the knight just kinda overruled as far as combat went.
Yeah.
And you were just constant, because the butt slam's a one hit kill for most things. And I'm just like, it would have been nice if there was a little more value to the other characters for combat. But pretty much the only time that you find them particularly useful is against elemental enemies, where you may want to swap over to the thief, because you can use her elemental arrows. Because if you use the opposite element, it's a one-hit kill.
Uh-huh.
So if you have, like, a giant spider that's ice and a giant spider that's far, hit the far spider with ice, hit the ice spider with far. They're both instantly dead. Two arrows, move on, bye.
And for the people who didn't get that, it's fire.
Fire.
Hit the ice to, like, ones with fire, hit the fire ones with ice.
We need to subtitle me, especially when there are elements involved.
When there's ol and far and snabbers involved.
The song of ice and far.
Yeah.
Ice and far.
Ass and far. But $30 on Trine 4, what do you say?
I think it's definitely worth it. It played well. I didn't have any issues with it. Like, no kind of freeze framing or crashing or anything like that. I was really impressed with how well it was optimized. It's fucking gorgeous. I think it might be one of the prettiest platformers I have ever played. And that says a lot, because I play a lot of platformers. But it's just really well designed, and it's so pretty. Yeah, it's by far easily worth the money that they're charging for it.
And even better value is to get the Ultimate Collection, where you get 4 games for $50. Yep. Bucks.
Can't be mad at that.
Can't be mad at that at all. But next game to talk about is called Ling, A Road Alone, developed by Chautauqua Games, published by Winking Entertainment, released October 2nd on PS4 for $7.99. Following the call of Inner Heart, the young man starts another journey of adventure. Faced with tough enemies and fierce fights, it is not certain whether the young man can reach the final. The only choice is moving forward with determination and clenched fists, swinging great sword. Chris, tell us about Ling, A Road Alone.
I think that one's Purnell. Oh, Ling, A Road Alone. Oh. Yes.
What?
Yeah, I completely heard the wrong title. I've just been calling it Ling, wow. And I thought you said Laying.
Nope.
Wow.
Oh, no, yeah, I'm reviewing Lane, A Road Alone. You're reviewing Ling, A Road Alone.
Yeah, see, that's the...
Very common.
They need to get us programs on that one. Oh, goodness. Sorry, I had to put another quarter into the phone booth.
Nice.
So I can continue the call. Ling, A Road Alone on the PS4. Yes, whatever you said in the description while I wasn't listening to you.
Nice. Ling, nice.
This is a... yes, this is actually a release of a game that was developed in China. Apparently, I guess it came out over there and did pretty well, so they brought it over here, which is nice. It is a very nice-looking, like... It's hard to call it, like, a top-down. It's kind of, like, isometric from the back sort of action game. But, yes, you play as, I suppose, Ling, who is I would say androgynous character, I guess, a dude, is what they described. Like, the thing is that there's nothing in the game to tell you what you are, what you're doing, or how to control the thing. Like, it opens up with a still shot of a campsite on a winter landscape, and you'll sit there and listen to, like, the vocal theme, which has no subtitles or anything like that. It's in Chinese, but you'll sit there and listen to it for a while until you realize, oh, this is just like a title screen or something. There's actually nothing going on, and I have to push a button to switch over to the game that I can play. But it was so pretty. I, like, sat there for, like, a minute, and I was like, is a title going to show up? Or because it just... I turned it on, and it just did that, basically. Nice. So I was like, all right. Yeah, so every time you start the game, it gives you a kind of a staring out the window with your feet up kind of view of the last area that you were in, including the beginning there. So that's kind of how the game tells you where you are, I found out. And... yeah, so you walk out, and you just kind of figure out that two of the buttons, cross and circle, they make you dash. And then the square button makes you punch, which is a fairly fast move. He loads up that punch, you know, he kind of winds it up a little bit. And then X is where you swing your giant-ass sword. Triangle. I don't review a lot of PS4 games, do I? Did I say cross, though, instead of X? I think I said cross.
You said cross.
Excellent. Okay, see, I'm a professional. and then if you play around with, like, the shoulder buttons, you find out they do a variation of the same. They also do the same stuff, just in a similar alignment. But anyways, you know, I mostly use the face button, so... Then, as soon as you kind of figure that out and you start walking around, then enemies start, like, just shooting in to the screen. They're very kind of, like, everything about the action is kind of small. You don't really, because it's snow and because, like, you know, it's, the camera pulls back a little bit, you can't really tell sometimes what the details are of what you're fighting. They look like dogs, but with kind of like weird, slimy, featureless spaces, like I don't know, a plant or maybe like a skull.
Interesting.
It's literally hard to tell. It's kind of like the closed four-leaf like mouth of the Demigorgons from Stranger Things, a little bit like that.
Yeah.
But they do nothing but like just run into you, so, and do damage, and thus, you know, that doesn't really matter what the faces are for. And then, you know, like that's kind of the thing. You know, there's these big trouncy bouncy like trolley kind of guys that bound after you and like start trying to punch you. And you also can't really tell much about them. They don't have much of a face. It's just they're bipedal and ambling towards you, and they do a lot of damage. So fortunately, you are tasked with nothing but the slaying of every creature that you see on the screen at any time. So you really don't have to know what anything is. You just have to kill it. So the way that combat works in this game, because really they give you very little else, is that anytime that an enemy comes at you, there's one of the two moves that you know, that, you know, the punching and the slicing, that like will do something to them. So like, you know, the dogs are very susceptible to, like, if they get close enough, you can you know, swing that big ass sword and hit them all. You could, if they jump at you, you can hit them with a punch, and that acts as a counterattack and a parry. And a parry will, of course, cause them to not do damage and be right in range of your sword, and then you can, you know, swing it. And it's all about that timing strategy. And the troll guys are even more so, because their life restores very quickly. So if you don't know how to defeat them, or you don't figure it out, you're not going to, because their life comes back too quickly for you to really be able to do anything. What you find out is that they're susceptible to a combo punch, which if you just keep mashing that punch button, eventually you'll do like this triple attack punch kind of thing. But and you know, you can take them down that way and just trade punches with them until you kill them, because when you kill them, your life restores because of health things that they drop, and also because I think just time out of combat just restores your life anyway. And but the thing you find out is that very, very quickly, like I would say within the first few minutes, is that it's not so much about just dealing all the damage and then dodging, because you just can't whittle down their life fast enough that way. It is all about learning when they're going to attack you and how, like, exactly when you need to throw a punch to get a parry and then stun them so that you can punch them some more and maybe throw a sword move in there or something like that. You know, at that point, you have a little bit more options. But the thing is to keep them kind of stun locked and keep doing damage until they're dead. And, you know, you just kind of keep running from area to area until you reach the first boss. Like, well, okay, so there is a first boss. The only reason I say it's a boss is because it's slightly bigger than everything else, and its face is glowing, but mostly because its health bar is not above its head, it's above the screen. So
yeah, I'm like, okay, that's a boss. Boss placement.
Exactly, yeah. And so I fought that little thing, and it was tough. You know, it took me a few tries. But, you know, of course, if you get killed, then you just infinitely start over at the closest point to where you were getting trapped in, because the game does that thing where it puts up the laser fence when you get into a cluster of enemies, where you kind of have to defeat a few waves of them.
Yeah.
Before you can move on, you can't just run past them. So you know, at any point before or after that is usually when it'll just auto save your progress and you can get right back into it. You never really have to worry about that, because there are no, like, physical checkpoints or anything. And then, you know, I beat that guy. I was like, all right, cool, next area. And then, you know, I kind of got a little further along and then realized that there is actually a boss, much bigger than everything else, and actually, like, you know, much bigger than me, and very, very, very hard to beat. It's a, yeah, it's this thing that, like, you know, with a couple of clubs, and it like raises its arm to like club you, and then you have to like be able to time a punch to get it basically right in the armpit as that arm is coming up, and that stuns it for several sword slices. This boss, like everything else, can heal itself completely if you are not staying on top of him and doing damage consistently, whereas you just assuredly are not only when you successfully land a combo of strikes do you get your life refilled. And, oh my god, it took me so long to take that guy down. Like, basically, I was done playing it, like, shortly after. Which, you know, it just takes you to a different kind of scene, and then the same enemies but slightly stronger start coming at you. And at that point, I was like, okay, I think I know what's going on here now.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, the story is so stark and minimal. It, like, the only time text appeared on my screen at any point, besides in the menu options, which I'll get to in a second, was just to tell me a one-sentence, like, thing, like, about something. I don't even know. It was like, it read like a fortune cookie, basically. It was just like this one line of philosophical something, like some kind of rhetorical question. I don't even remember what it was. And it told me nothing about my character or my motivations. But I knew that I was running around, I had a sword in my hand, and that was the job. So the options menu gives you a couple of things. Like, it basically, you know, you can choose from a list of volumes that is, like, quiet, normal, loud, and max. And it starts at max. And it rings a bell every time you choose one, which is kind of funny to me. It also has beginner mode, which I don't know what that does. I think it just adds slightly more health to your collection. And in fact, I had it in beginner mode when I beat this boss after, like, you know, an hour of trying. Because, yeah. Oh, and that was the other thing about that boss, is when you whittle him down to half his health, he becomes about twice as fast, and it's much harder to hit him.
No, man.
So it's one of those kind of things. You know, the Dark Souls, perhaps influences, maybe a little obvious here. But no, it was like, the things that I liked about it, I mean, you know, it's straightforward. I mean, for fans of that, that's certainly the case here. The music is sparse. There's a vocal theme that I quite liked, and then once I got into the game, it was just snow wind sounds, the kind you hear in all video games when there's snow. Exactly, yeah, there's a lot of that. However, I have to say, the snow in this game, like, as somebody who, you know, I play Skyrim 20 hours a week, I've seen a lot of snow in video games. I grew up on Final Fantasy VI, you know? It's like, this snow in this game, like, on the ground, like, just the ground and the way that the levels look are fantastic. It really, really looks good. You know, the character is a little more minimal, like, featureless, like a lot of things in the game. The enemies and the hero are featureless, but the backgrounds are excellent. So I like that. I liked the way that the action plays out, and honestly, it does give you some scrolls that you can collect after certain battles that kind of describe moves that you can do. Whether those moves unlock after you do them, I don't know. One of them just said, one of them literally, and I do remember this, one of them just said, drop the cleaver. And I have no idea. I don't know what that means. There's no embellishment, and I pushed all kinds of buttons, and nothing helped. I looked at at YouTube to try and figure out what was going on here. Nobody seemed to know there either. All I could find were gameplay videos that always stopped before that really hard boss.
Oh, geez.
And then one guy that beat it, he's not American. He was, I think, Japanese, maybe Chinese. But either way, it took him, like, I scrolled through his 3-hour-long video, and yeah, an hour and a half of that was fighting that one boss. So I'm not alone here. That's a tough boss. And there's more to it than that. Like, there's more stages, so it's not just that. So I'm excited at how challenging this game is. It didn't really feel unfair. It just felt like, you got to play by their rules, and they will test you on how well you can learn it. Again, I was utterly fascinated by the backgrounds, but the enemies left me kind of about, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, overall, $8, what do you think?
$8, I think, is fair. I can certainly say that, yeah, at an under $10 game, there was nothing in this game that disappointed me. If this was like a $20 game, I would have some questions. so I think they hit it at just the right at the right point. So I think that I mostly recommend this game to people who are definitely looking for more of a challenge, who don't mind a game that seems like it's an action like type thing, but you know, you don't, for instance, there's no jump button in this game. You don't jump over anything.
Hmm.
You know, you dash from side to side, you punch, you stab. That's all there is. But the way that they implement that is in a really challenging way is really cool. Like, nothing about the game felt cheap in that sense. That boss, it was perfectly fair. It's just I was having to, like, learn with my thumbs how to beat that thing.
Yeah.
And I'd say that experience is definitely worth $8 to those who can stick with it. However, if you are looking for something with more depth or you're looking for something easier, you know, elsewhere you shall find it.
Yeah. All right. Well, next game to talk about is called The Alliance Alive HD Remastered, developed by Furyu Corporation, published by NIS America, released October 8th on Switch and PS4 for $49.99. An age of darkness has befallen the world. The dark current, a cataclysmic event caused by the demon's emergence, has decimated the population and divided land into separate regions, leaving the survivors to be subjugated by the demonic overlords. To reclaim their home and free their people, an unlikely fellowship of heroes will band together to spark a fiery revolution. Purnell, tell us about The Alliance Alive.
Oh, The Alliance Alive, to me, feels a lot like a sort of throwback game, throwback to how some of the older style RPGs used to flow, which, honestly, I come to appreciate because I play a lot of RPGs, and sometimes that old flair feels kind of missed in current models. Anyway, the best way to describe this game would be as if saying someone took the attack learning mechanics of Saga Frontier, merged them with the narrative exposition with some tweaks of Suikoden 3, and had a party with it. So the idea behind this game is that as you progress through the game, it flows in a series of chapters. Each chapter runs you through the story, and different times it will put you in control of a group of people, usually residing within different realms in this universe, because this is a grand world, but at some point prior to the start of the game, a race called Daemons caused some sort of cataclysm, which resulted in the world being split up into a number of segments, thereby resulting in all the characters living in environments that seem smaller than they make the world seem smaller than it actually is. And throughout the course of the game, aside from the fact that they're being enslaved by demons, but the demons are also enslaving the beast folk, who in turn also enslave the humans, there's this rather interesting dog pile of authority being piled onto humans, resulting in them wanting to receive a sense of freedom from that. And of course, because it's kind of cool to have that happen, you also end up meeting some other people within the different races being beast folk and daemons, who also decide they don't like the world being that way either. And through a series of interesting events, they all come together and band together to form, quote unquote, the Alliance to overthrow the daemon rule. And so the way the game plays, aside from what I mentioned about it being chapter based and each chapter reflecting on a certain group of characters until they inevitably meet up together, you are progressing through a series of story beats. For example, maybe say go to this tower to deliver this package. What that package is, well, could be a secret coded message to one of the resistance operations, or it could be cookies, or it could be both. Who the heck knows? Actually, you do know because you're playing the game. but you will be basically engaging in these missions, and as you are running around the map, whether it be a dungeon or the overworld, you will occasionally engage in monster combat. And combat is not random. The monsters are visible on the map, but when you do battle them, you go into a traditional turn-based RPG style. And on your turn, you are able to perform a variety of attacks, usually based on the equipment that you have on. You can have up to two different weapons equipped to every character at any given time, ranging from swords to bows to spears to axes to barehanded combat, which is a free equip. Like, you don't have to equip anything to have barehanded combat. So technically you have three row combs of attack options. And there's more weapons types than I even mentioned. There's a lot of them. There's like 10 different weapons in the game. So what happens is as you play, you do damage with your attacks with that type of weapon. But every once in a blue moon, you'll have what's known as an awakening. This is the Saga Frontier-esque element, where when you have this awakening, your character will learn a new attack that can be utilized by that character so long as that weapon is equipped. Now, the rate of which you learn these things is not random, but it's a hidden element. So you don't know when you will learn something. You don't even know the odds or chance of you learning something. The way in which to increase the odds of learning something, however, is to use talent points to upgrade your tech tree or your talent tree for that weapon type. So, for example, you might be using bow and arrows. You can turn on the Awaken New ability that lets you increase the chances of learning a new, you know, ability from the bow tree. Or there's a level above that makes you even more likely to learn one, so on and so forth. It's like three of them total, three different levels. But aside from that, you have no real control over when you'll learn something. But that's basically how you'll be gaining new abilities. Just fight with your stuff and eventually, holy crap, I have a new ability where my shield will actually block and do reflect damage. I like that. But in addition to that, in combat, at a certain point in the game, you would gain access to the ignition ability. And what that is your character goes in sort of an overdrive mode. I haven't noticed anything in regards to like a stat boost or anything like that. So that's kind of out the window. But what it also does offer to you is a sort of overdrive attack. And what this does, it allows you to use whatever weapon you're equipped with to do a super move that does a lot of damage. However, the trade-off of using that move is that the weapon you were using breaks. So you cannot use that weapon anymore for the combat. And after the combat, the weapon's broken status is so bad, you're not going to want to use it until you get it repaired later in the game when you gain access to the Blacksmith Guild, which I will talk about shortly. So basically, that's how combat will pretty much flow. You can get a decent number of party members in your game. Like, I like these RPGs that are popping up lately where they give you more than three freaking party members to use at one time. In the case of this game, you get five at a time in your party, and it's freaking nice. So the way that you explore the map, there's a number of different ways to get around. There's just traditional walking. There is a ship that you eventually get. There's like cool hang glider abilities. It's honestly, the world becomes much bigger and it feels much more fun to explore as you gain access to new rides and you start to realize what different realms exist within the game as you're trying to traverse back and forth to access different points. But the game, difficulty-wise, it's honestly only until a very certain point, the game is very light. Like, I don't find it very difficult. This is even including the fact that healing in the game isn't your traditional healing as far as like typical RPGs go. So healing in a usual game is using items or spells. In this game, you can get spells, but only they can only be cast if you have an equipped item that has the ability to cast magic. And when you do that, the spell will use the same SP gauge that your attacks will use. And while you do get one SP back per round, unless you upgrade your tech tree to give you more per round, you will find yourself not wanting to use your SP item or your SP to use magic attacks or magic healing if you can help it. The other way to heal your characters is by using items. But unless you equip a specific item called the medicine pack, you cannot use all the items in your inventory for healing. You can only use up to two that you have equipped. So chances are eventually you're going to come across med packs and decide this character needs to be my main item healer and whatever and do that. But essentially it means that you're not going to want to heal all that often if you don't have to. But due to the game being fairly easy, battles run fairly quickly. So aside from certain bosses or the occasional water devil, which is a monster that's a bit more overpowered than the average beast who exists on water for interesting reasons. They bring up later in the game. Aside from those guys, the average battle is kind of a joke, but it doesn't make the game bad. I mean, I like myself a fair bit of challenge when I can get it, but let's be honest here. Sometimes you just want to have fun, walk around the world, see what there is to see, gain abilities and what have you, without having to deal with all the stress and fuss of, you know, hitting your head against the wall. So you'll get that from this game. I will say I do enjoy the character personalities that exist in this title too. I mean, I'm sure someone can sit there and go, yeah, this is the typical archetype, the 15-year-old soldier spy, whatever, the typical gruff with a heart of gold guy or whatever. But honestly, there are archetypes for a reason because they freaking work. And quite frankly, I enjoyed seeing the different characters interact in this game. I was especially fond of Professor Tiggy, who walks around with a giant rubber ducky mech suit. It's really nice. It's really freaking nice and adorable.
I want one of those.
Honestly, if someone claims to not want one, they're wrong. I mean, You got Untitled Goose Game over here. People are flaunting about that, and I do love the game, but let's be real here. I want a duck power suit. I would much prefer that to Untitled Goose any day of the week. Don't like it? Too bad. That's my thoughts. I want them. But yeah, I definitely feel as though this game, you have to be more interested in wanting a more classic style of gameplay or as far as your RPGs go, because you're not going to be getting anything revolutionary here. There's no voice work. The cinema scenes are characters doing movements and their mouths are moving, but there's words at the bottom of the screen that you still have to read. I do like the fact that you can pause the cinema scenes if you're like kind of like walking around your house or something, you're interrupted. You can pause it and come back to it. It's a nice feeling there. But yeah, the game itself is very traditional, very traditional. You're not getting anything new out of this, but you are getting a quality experience. And I also wager that the difficulty is probably going to be more of an, I think it's going to be more of an allure for people, honestly, because again, I think narrative RPGs are becoming more in season these days. So I think this is a quality candidate for that.
Awesome. Then $50. What do you think?
I would say if you don't have this on your 3DS already, I think this is a quality purchase because they definitely did a nice job with bringing the graphics up to make it a little prettier. They made use of that full screen size. There's no shrunken images here. They actually optimized it for the Switch display in your television set. I think it's worth the money, to be perfectly honest with you. And I say that as a person who's got the 3DS version sitting over here right now, actually staring at the box as I talk to you about it. So
yeah, I'm looking at my box too.
That's always that's happening with me a lot too. Like I get a game, I buy it, and I'll just have it on the shelf, and I'm like, I'll get around to it, and I'll play it a bit, and I'll put it back, and I'll get around to it. It's like, hey, there's this updated version. One review is like, I'd rather play the update. Gimme. Yeah.
And I'll just Cole, do you that. Think I'm bad? I'm not the only one.
Oh, I'm terrible at that. I am terrible at it. Like I reviewed the Surge 2 last week. Surge 1 sitting on my shelf. What is Surge 2? It's the better game. Yes. Gimme. I'd rather play that. But you bought the old one. Hey, I gave them money, which is why they were partly why they were able to afford to make Surge 2. I did my part. Did my part.
Oh, man. All right. Well, next game to talk about is called 80 Days, developed and published by Inkle, released October 1st on the Switch for $12.99. 1872 with a steampunk twist. Phileas Fogg has wagered he can circumnavigate the world in just 80 days. Choose your own route around the world, traveling by airship, submarine, mechanical camel, steam train, and more, racing other players and a clock that never stops. Chris, tell us about 80 Days.
Hey. Yeah, 80 days. Sorry. Okay, so this is a game that is actually a few years old right now. I think they like to tout the accolades that they got in 2014.
Yeah, I think it's Time's Game of the Year or something like that.
Yeah, which is like really pretty interesting. But, you know, certainly a lot of has gone into this game. It's at its heart, kind of a visual novel, but you're so constantly making choices that it actually just becomes like this whole kind of other thing. Somebody compared it to a board game, and I thought that was actually pretty apropos, like even though you play it by yourself.
You have Purnell's interest now.
Right.
Don't tell him.
But, yeah, this is a game that, they actually, purport to have 500,000 words of text in this game, which
that's
is
a lot.
Yeah, I think that is quite a lot more than, you know, what Jules Verne ever wrote, you know? Then again, I don't know. I'm kind of a buffoon. I don't really read a lot of classics. I have never read Jules Verne, so I cannot tell you how this game holds up to the original book, but maybe that's for the better because it's a very old book. And anyways, so what happens is that you start your adventure, and basically, you know, your boss is that Phileas Fogg or whatever his name is, Phileas whatever.
Phileas Herb?
No. That would be a whole different kind of game that I would still play. But, you know, he's your eccentric millionaire boss who tells you about a wager. And your character is Passepartout, the French, I suppose, I don't know, you would say like a dog's body or something of this guy. Like, he just kind of does everything for this rich guy. Everything from, you know, of course, you know, either trying to talk him down from even doing the whole thing, or showing nervous apprehension, or just like, you know, stoic acceptance. Hey, it's very good, sir. You know, that sort of thing. You have all of those dialogue options. And in fact, they, you know, funny enough, I never gave the game a chance to tell me that we were going to go around the world in 80 days, because as soon as he started talking, I just immediately started agreeing with him on everything, where I was like, I don't care what it is, we're doing it. And it was like, you know, Phineas trusts you more now, or something like that. You know, like, you get little, you make stronger connections with characters and stuff like that. So the way that it plays out, the actual visual novel part, is that it, you know, it starts the text. It basically gives you a paragraph or two of things that have happened. And then what you do, and this is actually something I've not seen yet in this style of book, it actually starts multiple other sentences. Like, it gives you the first few words of the sentence that you get to choose what happens next, and you kind of have to guess what the end of that sentence is going to look like. So it says, you know, he says something and it's like, I reach for the tea tray and, you know, or I interrupted and said, you know, and things like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it gives you those kind of options, so you don't have a clear sense of what exactly you're committing to when you choose a new sentence. And, but, you know, I kind of got the gist of it when we start you know, once you start out on your journey, you end up in all these different towns, of course, different places where you've stopped and are, you know, having to do the main part of the gameplay. And I kind of figured out that oftentimes the last option will just tell whatever, you know, it basically cuts off the story at that point and moves on to something else. So I noticed that tended to be pretty consistent, and you kind of do get enough context clues to sort of know whether you're arguing with somebody or whether you're going along with what they're saying, or, you know, anything. And all of this leads to getting more information about what the fastest and or safest route is to get to your destination, of course, which is the place you started, but from the other side. So from the other side. So yeah, you can basically kind of plan your trip along that. Now, when I say safest and fastest, that kind of segues into the main things that you have to be concerned about in this game. Obviously, there's an overall world timer that tells you how many days have gone by and how, you know, and obviously 80 is the cutoff if you want to get a, you know, the best result. But there's also, on the bottom right, there's a number associated with the health rating of your eccentric millionaire boss. You have to make sure that he's taken care of, and you have to make sure that his spirits are up. Otherwise, you know, basically things are going to happen and you're going to end up stalling and losing time. But, you know, there's nothing, like, as far as I can tell, there's nothing violent or dangerous that actually ever really happens. It's more like, you know, oh, this bad thing happened and now we have to wait another day to leave town. And, you know, obviously that's bad because you don't want to wait too many days. You only have 80 of them. And then the third aspect, of course, is money management. You start off with a pauper's fee of several thousand dollars, and, you know, you whittle that down constantly. Anytime that you travel, it costs money. Doesn't matter whether you're going by plane, train, automobile, or moving city, actually is one of them. Cause this game deals with like a lot of fantastical stuff that I'll get to in just a moment.
Yeah, like mechanical camel.
Yes, mechanical camel, exactly.
I like that more than the floating city concept.
Exactly, yeah. So we'll get to that. The first thing that you do, kind of rolling it back to the beginning of the game, the first thing that you do is actually choose items that you're going to take with you in a suitcase, because, you know, this guy can't even pack his bags, you know, his own bags. And you choose items based on things like this would sell really well if we took it to Berlin, or this would sell really well in, you know, over here. And then, like, for some reason, I haven't quite discerned what the purpose of it is. There's, like, this is part of the Gentleman's Travel Set, one of three. And, like, if you have a complete set, I have no idea what happens. I assume it might have something to do either with the ending or with some kind of... some kind of dialogue option, but it's all kinds of different stuff to figure out. And when you get all this to say, when you get to a city and you go shopping, you can, of course, sell things, and different items have different worth depending on where you are in the world. You can also purchase things. It's kind of
like a stock market aspect to it. Buy high or buy low, sell high, stuff like that.
Yes, exactly. And you can also purchase items to take to other places, or even use. Like, one of them is actually useful. It you know, like an altimeter, like, tells you, it opens up more locations. You can see them on the maps. You can better trace your route without having to get lost, essentially. Because, you know, you might end up, you know, going to Budapest, and then suddenly, you know, you're going backwards or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. And then... when you're purchasing more items, obviously they don't all fit in the same suitcase. The suitcase holds like five items, and it's Resident Evil style. It's like, you know, larger items take up more room in the suitcase. Mm. But you can purchase more suitcases, and then so obviously I did that, and I cleaned out the store because I was like, whatever, I'm a millionaire. Or my boss is a millionaire. I'm just going to spend all his megabucks. And sure enough, like, I bought some more suitcases, filled them up, and then had to move on. And they were like, well, you've got all these suitcases now, and now you have to hire extra cars to take them with you. So that's going to triple the cost of moving to the next area. And I was like, oh, I'm out of money. And
that... spent so much money on luggage, you couldn't afford a car.
Exactly. Well, I couldn't afford the three cars that it apparently takes in Victoria and Times to, like, move. Like, apparently nobody in that era could hold their suitcase on their lap. So no,
that's
I had to hire an entire car to haul my boss's, like, suitcase that had his Gentleman's Travel Set in it. Which, anyways, and then, of course, when you run out of money, you can always get more money either by selling stuff or just going straight up going to the bank and being like, excuse me, sir, I'd like several thousand dollars. It's okay, I'm rich. And when you do that, it's like, okay, we'll do that, but it's going to take 4 days to approve the loan. So you got to figure out what to do for 4 days. I was like, great. Bark. Yeah, so... you might end up doing that if you're not careful, like I wasn't. And, you know, at that point, though, while you're waiting around, that's where the real, like, quality, I think, of the game's writing comes out. Because you basically can take yourself on an adventure where it's just choosing different options of what you want to look at, who you want to talk to, what you want to talk about. And as you do that, you kind of figure out, like, a little bit more about the makeup of the world, because there's no backgrounds in this game. The entire game takes place with a globe in the background that just shows the dot of where you are and the dot of where you're going. And then you see character portraits based on who you're talking to. But you can, like, talk to people who are, like, building robots, because in, you know, steampunk, essentially. It is in the sense of, like, it's a more advanced post, like, you know, post-industrial revolution, like, kind of, like, modernism, but it's not like the top hats with the gears on them or anything like that, so thank God. But yeah, you can actually talk to people and, like, learn about their jobs and stuff, you know, you can, and the cool thing is that when you do this and you're more outside of Europe, you're actually talking to more diverse people, and the game handles them really well. Like, it doesn't, you know, if you go down to Africa and start talking to a pilot who's working on a new kind of plane, it's like the game doesn't fall into that trap of this style of writing in making him seem othered or like a different, like, oh, this is exotic that I'm talking to these people who aren't white, you know, and myself, I'm the servant of a rich white guy. It's just like your characters are just kind of in the background and everyone else has their story. And so I really, really like the quality of the writing and how it treats the other characters. And in a globetrotting game, you want you know, the whole spirit of the Jules Verne style travelogue kind of thing is that you want to learn about more people in different places. You're not in like the position of, you know, authority or power in any situation. Pretty much everybody knows more than you do. You're kind of just a burden. but you're there to learn about people and things. And, like, I really like that aspect of the game. And you can really get lost in that. Like, you can just sit there and, like, you know, I was like, 4-day loan, whatever. I'm going to talk to all these people and, like, learn about this place. And you can literally sit there and, like, go through each and every, like, possibility for your next destination. And they'll tell you, like, what is going on in that place, how they feel, how they would feel about an ex-military French person, which is Passepartout's past, you know, how they would feel about a French person being there and for what reasons and all this other stuff. Like, you get to learn about the politics of all these different places too, and like what kind of situations you might run into there. So this game is very simple on the, you know, on the face of it. But when you actually start digging into it, you can see, like, why it took 500,000 words to create this game is because there is a lot of care that's gone into this thing. So it is deceptively deep. And nice. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it for that aspect of it alone. And in a game that's mostly a visual novel, you want to read it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rest of it, like, it, you know, it seems that it's, you'll get to the end no matter what. There's no way to, I think, game over. I haven't passed the 80-day mark yet on my character, so I thought about just crashing and burning it, but I kind of ran out of time before we recorded. So, there are several endings and many, many ways that this whole game can play out, and you're going to want to see all of it, so.
Nice. Well, $13, what do you say?
Yeah, $13, I'd say definitely. I mean, God. I'm surprised they didn't charge more. I think the reason for that, though, is that the look of it is super simple. So this is really a game that, like I said, it has depth. It's an iceberg of a game. Doesn't look like much on the top, but underneath it's just massive.
Nice.
So I think that 13 is definitely a good entry point into exploring that iceberg.
Awesome. Two more games left. We're almost there. Don't worry. Cole, you're going to be able to sleep soon.
But oh, Pardell, not you. I've got
a doctor's appointment in the morning.
Well, you can just blame Chris.
No.
Okay.
Next game to talk about is Yellow and Yangtze, developed and published by Dire Wolf, released September 30th on Steam for $14.99. Lead your dynasty to victory in the Warring States period of ancient China in the new digital adaptation of the acclaimed board game. Purnell, tell us about it.
So, Rainier Kinesia, I don't know a ton about his background, but what I did know about him and why I wanted to do the review is because he's done two games I'm familiar with. One being Lost Cities, which is a really awesome two-player card game. And then there's another one called Tigris and Euphrates, which I've actually never had a chance to play, but I've heard people talk of it in the VG community, almost like it's some kind of legendary game. So to hear that this game was coming out by Rainier Kinesia, and that it's apparently a sequel to Tigris and Euphrates, so to speak, I wanted in. So I got a chance to try it. And this is a game that I would have to say is easy, I think would be easy to teach, but it has a lot of meaty decisions, which results in it being quite the challenging endeavor, which is a good thing for this kind of game. So the idea is that it's basically a war-style game of sorts where you have five general chips and you have like a hand of six general chips, and which I'll get into them in a second. So you have leader chips, and each leader, there's like a leader, it's five different factions, and there's leader chips related to each of those. So there's the governors, the soldiers, the artisans, the farmers, and the traders. And what ends up happening on each turn is you can do up to two things. Oh, you get two different actions. And one of them being you can put down a chip, and the other one being you can, well, I'll get into those in a second because I might need to start with the chip placement. So starting out, you have to put down what's called a governor tile. Governor tile will establish a city on the hexagonal board that you'll be playing on. And once you set that down, you can then create what's called a state by placing one of those governor tiles I mentioned earlier next to it. After that, the players will be proceeding by placing a variety of different tiles on the board, being a trade, like one of the ones I mentioned, the trader, the farmer, whatever. And each one will generate points in its own special way. So, for example, soldier tiles, if you have the soldier general down on a state area, and you place a soldier tile down next to it, you'll generate a point based on just that connection existing within the same state. And it's a weird way to describe it in the sense that you're like, okay, well, this is... sounds very straightforward, and it kind of is. There's not a lot to say as far as like how the complication there is in placing the tiles. It's all about the strategy of when you'll want to do it, because certain tiles have special mechanics that make them useful. For example, there is farmer tile. Farmer tiles, I don't know why they're called farmers, because you can only place them in water areas on the board. But unlike the other tiles, if you have multiple farmer tiles on your hand, when you place one, you can place them all at once. So you'll be wanting to do it, try to get a bunch of them down to score a ton of points. Now, you don't want to just go bonkers on one type of tile placement, because the way you score and determine the winner of the game is it's the most points within your least accumulated point value. So if you went nuts with soldiers, but then ultimately didn't do anything with the farmers and got like 2 points there, your score at the end of the game will be 2 points. So you really don't want to do that. So it's all about diversifying how you place your tiles and when, and taking advantage of like when your opportunities will arise to place the tiles. So let me see here. So I wrote down some stuff. It's weird, like when you're playing a game, it's one thing like, okay, I know what I'm doing. It's nothing to write down specific stuff. And here we go. So, and it isn't just normal placement of tiles. There's a few other mechanics that will make this game a little bit more strategic, as opposed to just I'm laying tiles all day. What the frick's the point of making, how's this game fun? So one thing that there is something called a pagoda. Now, pagodas are specific buildings that can be placed down when you've laid down tiles, three of one type of tile in a triangular formation. And when you lay it down, and when you lay down that formation and acquire it, you will get 1 point from that category every round, as long as you maintain control of the pagoda, which can be taken if another player builds another pagoda and there aren't enough on the board to accommodate, because there's only two of every type in the game. So you'll be kind of trying to hold, maintain control of those to get points. In addition to that, there is something called a revolt and something called a war. So remember how earlier I mentioned there's like 5 governor tiles, one of every different like typing, like the soldiers and the governors and the farmers, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So when you place one of these tiles down in a state, it's like, think of it as like its own little nation or country. If you place, say, your soldier governor down in a place, that is where your soldier leader is residing. And you can continue to build that state out and grow it however you see fit. And if another player decides they want to place their guy, one of their leaders within that country too, they can do that. They can put their artisan in there or their trader in there. And you will both be mutual residents in that facility or in that state. But at the same time, if someone wants to play a tile related to whatever the leader is, that person's leader will get all the points for that. So if the other team puts an artisan general in your state that you're working with, you can't use artisan tiles there anymore, else you'll be giving them free points. You don't want to do that crap. But if you were to, say, place your own artisan tile in there along with theirs, you will start a government uprising. And at that point, whoever has the most governor tiles within that region, they will take control of that area. And if you happen to have any governor tiles in your hand that you haven't played yet, you can dump them out immediately to just kind of bolster your strength and kind of come at it from the blind side. Like, oh yeah, you thought I only had 2 because that's what's on the board, but I'm actually playing 3 more from my hand. Thereby, I won this round. And you can eject them from the village, and that becomes your zone to build points on, and you get points for knocking them out. And the other element, and the one that I thought was actually a lot more intriguing, is a war. So you can build out the different states across the map as large as you can get them. No big deal. The only restriction to size is just tile placement. But in the event that 2 different states get connected by 1 tile, you create a war scenario. And what happens here is every leader tile that has a conflicting leader tile on the other side battles it out. It's like one massive war. So let's say me and player 2 and player 3 each have tiles on the left side, the left city, and on the right city, player 4 has a tile that conflicts with all 3 of us. That means it's official that all 3 of us are battling against that one guy right now. And if we beat him, we all get benefits from that. We all get points accrued from knocking him off the board. whereas he is kind of screwed. So it, and instead of using governors to battle, you use your soldiers to battle, and you can still do the same thing. I mentioned how you can pull governor tiles from your hand. You can pull soldier tiles from your hand and do the same thing to bolster your strength up and kind of surprise them from the side there. Honestly, this is a weird game to describe.
Yeah, sounds it.
It really is. Like, and I got to admit, this is something I get used to when it comes to talking about. So I'm used to describing video games, but it's very rare I get to describe a board game. So that's something I got to build up. But what I can say about this game is that I honestly very much enjoyed playing it. I didn't even bother with the story mode. Instead, I just played the, you can create individual games. Like, I want to play right now. And I set it up to do with different player counts just to see, you know, if it would scale well with 2 players, 3 players, or 4 players, because you can always throw AI in there. And what I came to just realize is that it does scale very well, but at the same time, it loses some level of excitement when you don't have, you know, more than 2 people battling it out, because you don't have those multiplayer wars that can take place. It's just 1v1, which doesn't make it a worse game. It's just the difference between chess and like a battle royale, you know? So, but I think this game is a fantastic play. Again, it's a game where the rules don't get extremely complicated. I didn't even mention the idea of like peasant revolts, and which allows you to destroy tiles right off the bat. Just knock them off the board. But but the game doesn't have, it's not extremely complicated as far as like if I sat there and explained the rules with the board in front of me so I can just point to different stuff. But once you learn the game, it's applying those rules against another player or players that really sells it and makes it shine. I love when games do that. I love when games aren't complicated in explanation, but they are complicated in execution, because it makes the game feel like it's dang near infinitely replayable. You'll always feel as though you can make a new strategy, and there's no, typically anyway, there's no default, if I do this, I'll always win play that you can run with. There's always something you have to do on the fly to shake things up. And I like the fact that every tile has its own specific purpose. They're not all just like one-note tiles, like the soldiers are meant for battles. If you play a traitor, it allows you to pull a new tile from the tile pool that's off to the side, and so on and so forth. And also worth knowing, the way that you determine when the game is over is every time you've played a round, you'll draw new tiles from a bag, which in this game is just, you know, there's no bags. You're not reaching into anything, but it's just a set of tiles. And the game always shows you how many tiles are left that can be drawn. Once that pull, that bag has nothing to draw from it, the game is over. And that doesn't matter if you're holding on to tiles. So if I pull the last tile out, I don't get to play my hand. The game is just over right then and there. So you want to also be, it makes you feel cognizant of knowing when you want to draw tiles, when you want to play tiles. You want to try to, you know, maybe make a turn run where you're just playing your governor tiles just to buy yourself some time, whatever. It's a lot of cool mechanics that you're just playing around with. It's highly strategic, lots of fun. Visually, though, I will say, don't come to this game expecting some sort of visual flair, though. I guess you probably shouldn't be. I mean, it's a freaking board game, strategic board game, but with that said, there's still no, like, there's no, like, a bunch of army soldiers running across the board when a war starts. It's literally just, here's some numbers at the top and, like, an emblem. What do you want to do? You know, it's fairly straightforward. No muss, no fuss, but it's not ugly either. It's just straightforward. So, I think it's fantastic.
Well, then $15 on it, what do you say?
If you were able to understand how I explained that game, know that I had a fun time talking about it and playing it, and I think it is worth the money. I think it's very much worth, especially because if you want to get the physical version of the game, like the actual box of a board game, this is a $60 game. Easy.
Damn.
So to get it for $15 digitally and mess around with the rule set and be able to play it online, I think that's a great play.
And not have to worry about losing pieces and shit like that.
Exactly. Because on one hand, I will say I'm always that guy that prefers having physical bits, but when you can get the cost breakdown, you can get the cost lessened exponentially, I think that's a fair trade-off. Also, yeah, you don't have to worry about the space in your house being taken up by a giant box.
True. Very true. All right, well, we got one final game to talk about tonight that is called Aldred Knight of Honor, developed and published by Cubite Interactive. It released October 8th on the Switch for $1.99. In Knight of Honor, you are Aldred, the most powerful swordsman of the Divine Flame, passing through innumerable obstacles and war bosses to rid the kingdom of a great evil. Chris, tell us about Aldred.
I love that we saved the best for last. A $2 Switch game. Yeah, this is it. This is it, folks.
Serious. Like,
this the moment you've all been waiting for.
Hey, we've covered cheap stuff before, and they turn out to be pretty fun most of the time, so I'm excited to hear about this one.
Yeah, this is one of those times. Nice. Yeah, so $2. No, just kidding. So yes, Aldred, the Knight of Honor, I had to look at it. I just remembered it was Aldred, because I'm like, that looks like Alfred, but, you know, mistyped, which, you know. I think we had a game like that was... But anyways, okay, so this is a throwback retro platformer. Hard to say what the vintage is that they were going for with it. Like, it kind of looks like NES and then kind of looks like SNES sometimes. But yes, this is... it's got a lot of different elements to it. So your character, Aldred, kind of looks like a... a little bit of a Ghosts and Goblins, you know, Arthur type of character. And certainly he comes equipped immediately with a double jump. So that'll tell you something. I have to say, and this is just right off the bat, that if you've got $2 to spend on a Switch game, you should spend it on this game only because they gave this guy the most fabulous jump that I think I've ever seen. In a retro throwback platformer, he like tucks both his arms like behind his head and like thrusts his elbows out and just like puffs his chest out and then like kicks his knees back for both the regular jump and the double jump. It just looks like this fabulous, like, it looks like a fashion pose, like, coupled with like kind of like this pelvic thrust, but, you know, from the chest.
Plus 10 to flare.
Yeah, exactly. And I just love it. Every time I see it, I'm like, hee hee hee. And so you start the game, and he has a sword and he has a fireball spell. These are both changeable throughout the game. He also has a third move, which I'll get to in just a second. So basically, your sword, think of like Castlevania in that, you know, so you got your on the ground like slash, which just is a head high slash that is pretty quick, won't get anything above you, won't get anything beneath you. It just gets stuff that's straight ahead of you. While you're doing one of your fabulous jumps, then the sword swing actually then becomes an overhead swing. And that's how you have to get rid of, things that are like flying at you. You actually have to jump and slash at them instead of just trying to slash them, because they'll probably get you. It has a kind of strict three hit health bar. You know, three hits and you're done, and you can cast three fireballs and you're done. And then there's a third thing, which is represented by a little yellow jewel underneath both of those indicators, and that is a transformation move. So if you push the X button, so like jump is B and slashing is Y and magic is A, if you push the X button, he'll use one of those and become an invincible gold-plated version of himself with like twice the hit power for approximately 10 seconds. And so, you know, you can basically use those. You can use that once a life or once, you know, in the every stage and such. The stages proceed along linearly. That is to say, as soon as you're done with one stage, you start the next stage. But when you start the game in total, like if you've reset it or gone back to the main menu, you can choose a level and then replay it if you want. The reason you would want to do this is because in these levels, which of course are made up of platforms, enemies, and traps and things like that, and a little bit more that I'll get into, there are three, I don't know what you would call them, I guess bad guy statues. It's like these purple statues of like dragons and stuff, and you have to smash them. You have to smash three per level. And then also every level has one villager who is being tied up that you have to like attack with the sword to cut them down, and then they exit out a conveniently placed door that's right next to them. And so the goal is to try and not only get through the stage, but to also get all three dragon statues destroyed and the one villager rescued. To what ultimate end, I don't know. might be a different ending or something like that. The game's actually pretty meaty in terms of content. There's several levels per world, and I'm not even sure how many worlds there are, but it seems like there's quite a lot to enjoy here, because the trailer showed a lot of bosses, and you don't see a boss.
There's more than 20 stages.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. And yeah, like I said, that's you don't see the boss until the end of several stages. And the bosses are actually really nice. I would invite people to take a look at the official trailer to see them. They're like, these screen size things, and each one has like a whole different like set of moves and stuff, which is a good contrast to the very basic enemies that are throughout this this game. However, what I will say is that they craft these levels to be on the one hand, pretty clever. Like, they place those enemies right in that spot where, if you know what you're doing, you can get there and attack them and avoid damage. But then, this is my troubles all started for me in level 5-1. They will, for variety's sake, occasionally break out into a moving platform stage where you have to dodge all kinds of deadly things from a tiny platform where you have to move off to one side enough that you're only just hanging on by your toe on like one side, because it's like that kind of game. A friend of mine refers to those as strong leg games. Where you could just stand there with one leg and like the other is just completely hanging off, and that's actually a mechanic somehow. Sorry, I just dropped my Switch on everything.
I just love that there's apparently so many games that play like that that you actually coined a strong leg game.
I think it's a good phrase and it should catch on. If your character can stand on a ledge with just the toes of one foot, that is a strong leg character.
Oh, wait, like Mega Man.
Yeah, Mega Man has very strong legs. I think the game in question that she coined the phrase from was ActRaiser 2, because on top of having those massive beefy thighs, the master also could stand on ledges like that, just on the edge of one sandal. Anyways, back to Eldred. So you have to strong leg your way through this platforming stage full of spinning ninja stars and wooden spikes and enemies. And the thing is that the playing screen, there's no way to like move it around, and there's no way to broadcast what's coming at you. So it then becomes that most reviled style of platformer, and that is the one that requires rote memorization, or else dying constantly and only getting like 3 inches past where you were last time every time you restart.
Yeah,
weirdly, in the straight up action stages with more enemies, they have halfway points. But in stage 5-1, I don't know what it was. It's just like the stage is so long and there's no halfway points or anything like that. And there's still enemies. It's just that, most of it is just like all these spikes and stuff. So that leads me to something else that I actually like in this game. And that is that when you destroy enemies, they drop coins, of course, because this is a sword and sandals game. Why wouldn't they? In certain stages, but always at a certain point, you can find a shopkeeper who has the whole, what are you buying kind of look to him. And when you go up to him, you can either purchase some short-term power-ups for, a paltry fee, refill your life meter or something like that, which you'll need because, again, you only get 3 hits unless you can heal yourself, and enemies don't drop heals. So you, actually really have to manage your hits. But if you happen to manage to die enough to have saved up, 1,000 coins, you can purchase an upgrade such as permanently more life, more attack, different attacks, all kinds of cool stuff, but they're expensive. So, they either require playing through levels and kind of grinding them up or, just dying so much, because it saves the amount of money that you have every time you restart. So you never lose money.
That's good.
So in that sense, you can definitely inch your way to freedom. That is to say, you can die enough to purchase the upgrade that you need to maybe get that extra little boost to get through the day, like maybe an extra invincibility cast or some extra magic or something like that. And really, I mean, I already felt like this game was pretty quality for its extremely low price when I was playing it just this way, because I like hard platformers. So I was like, this is a this feels adequately difficult, you know, and a little bit unfair, but nothing worse than anything I already willingly dropped way more than $2 on the NES itself. But like the fact that it does actually have a way to upgrade and proceed with your better character really won me over on this one. So I'm actually quite a fan.
Nice. Then $2 on Aldred Knight of Honor. What do you say?
I mean, God, what am I going to tell people? Wait till it's on sale for $1.
Which you never know. This right might be, now.
This might be one of those games that shows up on sale for 19 cents.
Yeah, or 9 cents or something like that. I hope never not, know. I actually do want people to pick this one up for $2. I think that it's very good. You get a lot of content for what it is, and it's noticeably difficult, but not in a way that is going to make you not want to play it, you know?
Yeah.
It controls well. It looks good. The music's actually really good, too. Quite fond of the music. And, yeah, it's just, and the bosses look really cool. Like, they're actually, you know, one of them's a lady the size of the whole screen. Like, it's, they got some really cool, interesting stuff in this game that they could have very easily just made, you know, a generic adventure and probably still gotten their $2 out of. So,
yeah.
Go celebrate good games for cheap. Go pick this one up.
I plan on it. It's only $2, so I'm going to grab it.
Yeah.
It's $1 right now. Get it for $1.
It is on sale for $1.
So it really is.
Is it?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's $1.
It is on sale for $1. Holy shit. I'm buying this.
All right, yeah, go do it. Yeah, the only other game that, like, I think is also just, like, way too damn cheap for its own good was Ninja Striker on the 3DS. That game is fantastic. I actually went and fully beat that one, and it was, like, $3, I think, when I bought it.
Damn. I love cheap games.
I know, there's so many good ones.
Oh, man, Well, that is it for this episode. It's been a long one. Thanks, everyone, for sticking with it and hanging in there and doing what you do. Thanks to Tim for coming on, talking about Indivisible. Thanks to all three of you for being here. Thanks to George for coming on, chatting about Ni No Kuni.
Tell us about cave culture.
Yeah, cave culture. music, I think I'll just play George's, SML 500 song again because it's fucking hilarious and I want to hear it again.
Yeah. Sweet.
So, Cole, do you have any final words to end the show?
Nope. Good night.
When you wake up, well, you know I'm gonna be the one who's talking out to you. When you go out, yeah, you know I'm gonna be the one still talking out to you. When you're driving, yeah, you know I'm gonna be the voice that's whispering to you. And in the bathroom, yeah, you know I'm gonna be the voice that helps you when you're weak and need to poo. 'Cause we have got 500 shows and we will make 500 more. Just to be the freak show podcast that you can't escape wherever you go. When you're listening, yeah, you know you're gonna be the one who's dropping bits for me. When you're laughing, yeah, you know you're gonna be the one who tells your friends of me.
When you're subbing,
yeah, you know you're gonna be the one who's subbing on to me.
And at breakfast,
yeah, you know you're gonna be the one who's passing all the syrup over to me. 'Cause I will eat 500 pancakes and I will eat 500 more. Just because we have a lot of pancakes here to eat and we're making more. It's high, dude. When you're lonely, yeah, you know you're gonna be right here and listening to me. When you're dreaming, yeah, you know you're gonna be the one who's dreaming about me. I am Joe Cam, and you know we're gonna laugh and fart and make shit up and do it on the fly. Yes,
I'm Joe Cam,
and you know you're gonna be the one who's listening to my show until you die.
Look outside your window, there I am. Please wave high. Cause we will have a ton of pancakes, and we will have a thousand more, just to eat a thousand pancakes and fall down in front of your front door. This is fucking high. You're high. Fuck you, motherfucker. Cause we will still be here to give away more codes and have a blast, just to be your favorite show.